Everyone, I'm going to open up the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for February 3rd, 2009. This is a public hearing. Actually, I'll also open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 76. Just a couple of housekeeping measures for folks, is that we have a lot of new guests in the audience today, and I am Chair Senator Dinkfelder. One of the things I will first ask is if anybody has a cell phone or a pager or BlackBerry, they could please turn that off because it does interfere with our sound system. We have people listening over the Internet, so we want to make sure that they can hear. So I will first ask that. Also, I want to mention that we have an overflow hearing room in Room A, so if anybody feels it's getting too stuffy in here and want to listen but not be in the room, there is the audio and also we have a big screen, so you can watch us all up here. I also want to mention that we have sign-up sheets, so if you would like to sign up to testify, please make sure and sign up. We have some sheets over there on the side, and then I will be calling people up. And we will, because we have a lot of folks, I have a timer, so I'll be asking folks as they come up who have signed up to testify to keep their testimony to 3 minutes so we can make sure and hear everybody. If you do have written testimony, our ABLE committee assistant is the person you can hand it to, and then she'll distribute it to us. I'm also going to request, if you do have written testimony, please don't read your testimony if you've handed it to us, and please summarize, because that's the most effective way to get your viewpoints out. So just a few pointers there if this is the first time you're testifying in a committee. Anything that I've forgotten?
I think that's everything.
Okay, great. So with that, committee staff, Beth, can you please give us an overview? Oh, yeah. Okay. Actually, yes, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 76 just for a moment, and I'm going to open up a work session on the introduction of a committee measure, LC 1926. My able vice chair.
Madam Chair, I move LC 1926, dated January 23rd, to be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Senator Atkinson moves that LC 1926, dated January 23rd, 2009, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Okay. This is an issue that was worked on last session, went into a work group, and so it's back, hopefully in a consensus form, but obviously we'll be having a hearing at some point on this. Okay, without any further discussion, is there any objection? Seeing none, the measure is introduced as a committee bill. Okay, now back to Senate Bill 76. I will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 76, and Beth, if you can give us a brief overview. I appreciate it. And also, I'm going to, just a reminder, do you want to talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and talk about that when you're done.
So I'll be very brief, given that there's a lot of people here who want to testify, but Senate Bill 76 is a -2 amendment, and it establishes a framework for dam removal on the Klamath River, subject to final analysis and confirmation, directs the Public Utility Commission to set rates to allow Pacific Corps to recover Oregon's share of their undepreciated investment in the dams. In addition, we've been receiving written comment, and the chair has decided to allow the record to be kept open until 3 o'clock Thursday, February 5th, so people can continue to submit that. You can email that to me. My email address is beth.herzog@states.or.us, and we will include that in the record.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so given that, we will. Our first person up is Mike Carrier from the Governor's Office. And also, just a reminder for folks, when you do come up, we ask that you state your name for the record. Again, it's so you can identify yourself for the public record and for folks who are listening on the Internet so they know who you are. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Carrier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Carrier. I'm Governor Kulongoski's Natural Resources Policy Director. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today in support of Senate Bill 76. I want to state for the record that the governor requested this bill be introduced and has asked me to assure you that the amended version of the bill that's before you today continues to carry his unequivocal support. On his behalf, I respectfully ask for your support for this bill. Senate Bill 76 contributes in a major way to the resolution of decades of conflict in the Klamath Basin. This bill is the first important step toward implementation of the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, as well as the recently reached agreement in principle between PacifiCorp, Oregon, California, and the federal government that will ultimately result in the removal of the Klamath River dams. Since the ocean salmon season crisis of 2006, the governor has frequently called for removal of the four Klamath River dams as the most significant measure for restoring the health of the Klamath River, rebuilding salmon and steelhead populations, and sustaining Oregon's coastal economies and our ocean salmon fishery. This bill will enable the solution that has clear environmental and social benefits, but in addition, it represents a good business decision for one of Oregon's major electric utilities, a decision that offers certainty for the company and its shareholders, and moreover, guarantees cost containment and price stability for its customers. The alternative to Senate Bill 76 is to leave the dams in and to relicense those dams, in which the PacifiCorp customers would bear the cost of relicensing, the cost of modifications to the dam required to address the fish and water quality issues. And even after bearing those costs, the company and its customers would continue to be exposed for another 50 years to the risks and additional costs arising from the continued liability associated with operation of those dams. Today, you will hear testimony on all sides of this issue. Claims will be made that are based on a denial of the fact that the Klamath River, the third largest salmon producer on the West Coast, can once again contribute to the recovery of our West Coast salmon fisheries and Klamath River communities, including our tribal communities. Please do not buy into those denials, because it's untrue. Claims will also be made that the proposed bill is a corporate bailout, and it is not in the interest of Oregon's PacifiCorp customers. Please don't accept those assertions either, because they are false. And finally, you'll hear that you should not support the removal of hydropower dams in this era of emphasis on developing carbon-free sources of renewable and sustainable energy. In that regard, I ask you to consider the following question. Knowing the effects of these aging dams on salmon, steelhead, and red band trout, knowing the effects of the dams on water quality, knowing as you do the legacy of conflict in the Klamath Basin, and finally knowing that these dams represent only about 1% of the company's energy portfolio that can be easily replaced with renewable generation that the company is already aggressively building, doesn't remove these dams just make good sense? You'll also hear concerns about sediment and about liability. And in regard to those, I'll point you to the agreement in principle as well as the legislation which address the issues, and particularly in the agreement in principle, there is a provision for us to assess over the next 4 years with the Secretary of the Interior the costs, risks, and liabilities. But is Oregon accepting any undue liability associated with this agreement? No. No more than we would have normally in issuing permits for relicensing of this dam. In closing, I want to ask that you think about the vote you'll be taking on this bill early as this week. Your vote will be the very first opportunity for a legislative body to endorse and enable a truly historic accomplishment, the implementation of two agreements that seek to bring peace to a region that's been plagued with conflict for too long. Your vote in support of this bill will be an endorsement of a negotiated settlement by a record number of parties, achieved by diverse stakeholders, and that settles one of the West's most defining natural resource and agricultural problems. And finally, your vote will be a sign of confidence that here in the West, we can craft our own solutions to these natural resource, energy, and agricultural conflicts that plague our region. And the time to begin that is now. Thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carrier. And before we take questions, I apologize because I forgot to welcome our guests, Senator Nelson, down there on the end. We found your nameplate. Thank you for joining us. And also Senator Metzger. They are here because they're interested in this issue. They don't serve as voting members on the committee, but I appreciate your interest in being here today. So with that, any questions for Mr. Carrier? Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You made mention, obviously, the agreement in principle, which is actually not in the legislation. The agreement in principle does talk about some of the liabilities. I've heard from all kinds of people, and I'm looking for facts, not rhetoric and opinion, that I just heard. We're in a position where the bill draft as put forward says we're going to cap it at $180 million. The agreement talks about $450 million. The silt issues you raised, can you shed some light here on what agreements actually have been made from California, what legal weight they have? Has it been passed by the legislation, by the legislature down there, or is it just basically an agreement in principle?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, At this point, we have a signed agreement in principle that the governors of California, the Secretary of the Interior, Dirk Kempthorne, the president of Pacific Corp, and Governor Kulongoski have signed, and it's an agreement in principle that commits to getting to a final agreement to more fully address the issues. But if you look at the agreement in principle, you see it's fairly detailed. It does represent, with Governor Schwarzenegger's signature, a commitment on the part of California to fulfill the obligations that are stated therein. Your vote would be the first legislative vote of probably a number that would occur to implement both this agreement over time and the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. Now, in the case of California's share of the cost of this, because Oregon's share is going to come from solely from the ratepayer surcharge, California's share will come from a surcharge on its ratepayers, which is a smaller population than ours, and they're going to actually contribute more in the long run than Oregon by issuing a general obligation bond for $250 million. And I will say that the legislation authorizing that bond referral to the voters in California has already been introduced but not yet taken up. And obviously, there's, given that we're calling for dam removal in 2020, there's plenty of time for California to resolve its current fiscal crisis and pay it and then take its current attention to issuing that bond.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, so the position is our governor and the governor of California have the legal authority to raise revenue and expend dollars without their legislatures?
Madam Chair, Senator Boqvist, no, that is not the issue, and that is not what the governor is doing in his signing of that agreement. In signing that agreement, he committed to bringing legislation forward, asking for legislative authorization for the Public Utility Commission to make a determination and to order that that charge be issued. So he's following the law and he's following the process.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Okay, so I understand. I mean, we're capping it at $180 million. The Dash 2 amendment, which the governor supports, then talks about, in addition to that, amounts recoverable under the section include a return of investment. Farther on, it talks about annual revenue requirements, so on and so forth. So is that above or below the $180 million?
Well, those would be other costs the company would incur and are all costs that are recoverable through rate cases the company is currently eligible and expected to make before the Public Utility Commission.
Yeah, point of clarification, Madam Chair.
Clarification.
So we're saying it's above the $180 million?
Correct.
One final question, Madam Chair. You
said the state isn't going to assume any liability, and we'll hear expert testimony later about silt clays and everything else like that, but let's just assume it does cost an extra $100 million beyond what we pay and what California pays. Who do you suppose is going to pay that liability and pay those costs?
Madam Chair, Senator Boqvist, that's an excellent question. And when you have an opportunity to look at the agreement principle, you'll see that there's a provision in there that if those costs, in fact, do exceed the $450 million that is planned for to fund the decommissioning and dam removal fund, that the parties will meet and consult. There is an opt-out for any party if they can't reach an agreement on any issue like that, that they can terminate their participation in the agreement. But the 450 is actually a target that we agreed on that is significantly above what the last estimate was for dam decommissioning removal and was established at a higher number so that we could cover any contingencies within reason.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Carrier? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Stick around. There may be some other questions that come up. We have a couple of senators that would like to testify, so I'd like to invite them up first, Senator Schrader and Senator Whitsitt. Thank you for coming. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You'd like to go first, Senator?
Sure. Thank you for allowing us to testify. For the record, my name is Doug Whitsett. I represent District 28 in the Oregon Senate. First, I want to acknowledge all those who traveled a long distance to be here. There are many, so I will be brief. Senate Bill 76 creates the revenue stream to pay for the removal of Pacific Corp Klamath River Hydro Project dams. The agreement in principle reached by Pacific Corps, California, Oregon, and the Department of Interior cannot move forward, is my understanding, until that revenue resource is established. I want to make it clear, this bill is not about the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. This bill is about dam removal, and it is about creating a funding stream for dam removal. The first point I would like to make of three, the agreement in principle is an end run around the FERC process, in my opinion. That process, that FERC process, is a deliberative analysis of the science and of the economic issues that are in the best interest of the public. In my opinion, the agreement in principle replaces that deliberative process with political aspiration and, to some extent, economic doublespeak. I believe that the promise of excessive environmental regulatory costs, the promise of excessive costs for fish passage, and the promise of excessively reduced flows to the generation plants may have helped persuade PacifiCorp to give these hydroelectric dams to a dam removal entity in the agreement in principle. This agreement in principle process establishes the precedent to be used to force the removal of other dams. The ink was hardly dry on this agreement in principle before the websites and the blogs up and down the Klamath River lit up. We won. The dams are coming out. And the next target is the Snake River dams. Repeatedly. In the Snake and Columbia River dams, that effort is already being pursued. In 2007, the cost of salmon mitigation to BPA ratepayers was $980 million in round figures. $980 million. Part of that, about 60%, was actual charges to ratepayers, and the other 40% was a reduced flow, the cost of the reduced flow through the generation plants. Does that sound familiar? In the 2007 session as well, there was a concerted effort that never really got off the ground, but a concerted effort to reduce the pool behind those Columbia River dams for enhanced fish passage. Can you imagine what taking 6 feet off the top of the pools of all four of those Columbia River dams, or five or whatever there are, would have done to the generation capacity of BPA? The second point, the agreement in principle in the Senate Bill 76 assigned 90% of the entire cost of demolition and removal of the Klamath River hydroelectric project to the monthly bills of about 548,000 PacifiCorp ratepayers in Oregon. The proposed 2% surcharge on PacifiCorp revenue of about $930 million will produce about $18.6 million annually for 10 years, therefore accumulating the $180 million that would be Oregon's fair share of this agreement. We might ask why Oregon's fair share is 90% when PacifiCorp has customers in six states. We also might ask why Oregon's fair share is 90% when three of the four dams and much of the infrastructure is actually in California. The projected cost of the dam and infrastructure demolition and removal appears to be a small part of the near certain total cost of this entire demolition project. Section 6 of the Dash 2 amendment appears to me to leave an opened checkbook for additional charges on ratepayers. It allows any additional cost before dam removal to be recovered from ratepayers, and it allows all cost of replacement renewable power to be recovered from the ratepayer. That cost of replacement power was estimated by in the FERC EIS statement at about $35 million annually. I think you hear testimony today that there's many people believe that was greatly underestimated. And if we move forward with trying to replace that renewable energy with other renewable energy, the cost would be exponentially higher. The third point, in the FERC EIS statement, estimates there's about 9,000 acre-feet of sediment behind those dams. And they really don't know how much sediment there is because they didn't do the bathymetry studies before they built the dams. So they're just guessing. But they're guessing that there's that much. And in that estimate, they're only estimating 14 acre-feet behind J.C. Boyle Dam, and that's hard for me to believe. I mean, that's the first dam on the river, and it's below Keno, and it is also a pretty good-sized dam. So having said that, to put 9,000 acre-feet into perspective, That is about 14 square miles, 1 foot deep in mud. It's about 1,500,000 10-yard dump trucks of silt. It's a lot of dirt. The report went on to estimate the cost of removal of that silt to be between $150,000 and $500,000 per acre foot. So if you want to do the math, that ranges between $1.5 and $4.5 billion. That's with a B, $1.5 to $4.5 billion. The silt issue is simply not addressed that I can find in Senate Bill 76 or the Dash 2 amendments. In fact, I can't find where it's addressed in the agreement in principle. The alternative is to allow the sediment to flow down the river after dam removal. That sediment is unstable colloidal goo. The idea that the same thing would happen on the Klamath River as may have happened on the Sandy River when they took out the dam is, I don't think, a fair comparison at all. The Klamath River drains a huge area, and under storm conditions, it is a torrent going down the canyon. Under normal conditions, it is a magnificent whitewater rafting stream. That's how steep it is. Got 4 and 5 rapids all the way down. So it's, I can't understand how anybody could believe that that sediment is going to stay there. If it's not going to stay there, it's going to have to either be removed or it's going to wash down the river. It seems to me that the potential environmental liability is virtually unlimited. It's not addressed in Senate Bill 76. Who will pay? The Pacifico ratepayers? Probably not. The way the Dash 2 amendments is written, and I'm certainly not a lawyer, but it appears to me that that pretty well caps the cost of dam removal to $200 million to the ratepayers. But it does come down to, if this legislature indemnifies Pacific Corps by putting a $200 million cap on that liability, in the banking industry at least, if you indemnify somebody, it's like taking a second mortgage. You owe the rest of it. And so are we, in this situation, opening our general fund to up to $4.5 billion, 90% of $4.5 billion of environmental problems? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Whitsett. I think we'll let Senator Schrader go for, next, and then we'll take questions for both of you, if that's okay. Can you stick around for a minute?
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and honorable members of the committee. I'm Senator Martha Schrader. I come from the Canby area. I am a farmer and a teacher, and have been aware of water issues, I think, in my own neck of the woods, as well as having a unique opportunity to observe and talk to some of the folks who worked on this consensus down in the Klamath area. So I come here today just offering, at least from my perspective, some of the insights I have gained from observing that process. And this is what I have observed. Senate Bill 76, as it stands today, is essentially the outgrowth of negotiation and solutions-oriented effort between California, Oregon, PacifiCorps, and the federal government. It supports 3 years of efforts by a wide diversity of groups, tribes, conservation groups, farmers, ranchers, agencies, to develop a plan for the Klamath Basin that restores fisheries and provides stability to its rural communities. My observation is that this has not been any small task. Knowing some of the folks who were involved, it was contentious, it was arduous, and it took a number of years at the table. The settlement effort, we believe in this basin, provides flows for fish, water security for irrigators, economic development assistance for tribal and agricultural communities, and widespread coordinated restoration from the headwaters to the sea. The agreements contained in the settlement are predicated on dam removal as a cornerstone activity that will allow recovery of several species of fish, including salmon and steelhead. Another point I would like to make, that as they were going through this process, why utility rate making is somewhat complicated, I do think that there was a considered effort on all the parties involved to attempt to manage and consider that risk to the ratepayer. I won't go into some of the technical details at this point. I think that this beginning conversation that is starting in this committee and that will continue, I suspect, with those of us from both sides of the aisle in our caucuses will help tease some of that out. However, what I would really like to point out is this. The settlement effort and the restoration agreement are not the product of perfect consensus. Consensus was sought. I think that they did an excellent job trying to get there, but as is well known in government, sometimes it is very difficult to reach that point. I believe that there are detractors from both the left and the right on this issue, and that who would not accommodate or believe that litigation offers better opportunities than this agreement. But I do believe that the agreement, from my observations, is really coming from a broad spectrum of the middle. So with that, again, I think that there are a number of technical issues. Certainly I could talk about the dam removal, minimum cost of licensing in the same as the maximum amount under Senate Bill 76, what it takes to remove a hydro facility. I think that all of those technical pieces are going to be brought to the forefront. But as we consider this particular settlement, and if we can agree that the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement is the way to go, I think this will give us an opportunity to come together as a coalition of folks with solutions rather than the usual litany of problems. So in that sense, we'll have continued conversations. I know Chair Dingfelder, and I think that hopefully this will move forward as we go through the process.
Thank you, Senators, for testifying today. Are there any questions for either of the Senators? Okay, Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Senator Whitsitt, just hand us out this pack. I understand here, I see that the Board of Directors of the Upper Mid-Klamath Watershed Council voted unanimously on a resolution to oppose Senate Bill 76. And, you know, in my sense, and my working with watershed councils, probably mostly in my region, but sometimes throughout the state, that they have a pretty good understanding of, you know, issues, the local issues in the area. You also have somebody by the name of the Klamath Basin Alliance, Inc., that said they've collected more than 1,800 signatures from the Karuk Tribe, project irrigators, the Siskiyou, and the Basin Alliance oppose that. And then you also have somebody called the Southern Oregon Resource Alliance Group. I just would like to know something about those groups and, you know, their basis for their opposition.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. Yes, the basin, the full basin from the headwaters to the ocean are divided on this issue. It's my experience that the watershed councils are generally the members of those watershed councils are pretty representative of the irrigators and the farmers and the ranchers in the area. The particular divide within the Upper Klamath Basin is between the project water users, the reclamation project water users, and the off-project water users. And you will hear from both of them today, I'm certain. Mm-hmm. The off-project water users were one of two. Well, let me go back to the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement if we're going to talk about that. There was 26, I believe, groups that participated in the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, two of which were irrigator groups. It started out as a consensus group, so they felt safe in going along because in a consensus you can stop it with one vote. Along the way, it got changed to a majority vote group, or a supermajority vote group. The two irrigator groups got separated in that process, in that the upper basin people have already given up the better part of 100,000 acres to restoration, restoring some of the original swamps, restoring some of the land that had been reclaimed from the lake, the Sycan River. Between that and the Nature Conservancy restoration efforts, about 100,000 acres, this agreement calls for another 30,000 acre feet of water to be taken off, which would in that area could be as much as 20 or 30,000 acres more. So it's the upper basin people, and I certainly won't speak for all of them, but many of them believe that this is an inequitable arrangement for them. There are a number of people in the project itself who are really concerned. They're concerned about the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement for a number of reasons, but they're really concerned about dam removal. So it's a very contentious issue in the Klamath Basin, and that's one of the reasons I would like to see this discussion today focused on Senate Bill 76, which in fact is about funding a funding stream to remove the dams and whether that's a wise thing to do.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for both of you coming in. I know you're very busy.
Thank you so much.
So we have a couple of panels, and then we will go through the witness list. So I'd like to call up, and I'm going to ask you to come up all together because that way we can just facilitate this process. I want to make sure we get to hear everybody today, especially folks who came a long way. So I'd like to call up Jeff Mitchell, Greg Addington, James Honey, and Mike Becker. You have to pull up another chair. And just a reminder, if you have handouts, please give them to the committee assistant. And also, please make sure and state your name for the record. We have very sensitive microphones, so I'll let you know you don't have to sit up really close, a couple inches away, and we can hear you just fine. So thank you very much. Do you want to get started?
Yes.
You guys can duke it out. Who wants to start first?
My name is Jeff Mitchell. I'm a member of the Klamath Tribal Council, Klamath Tribes, Oregon. First of all, Madam Chair, we'd like to thank you and the rest of the committee members for giving us this opportunity to come up here and comment on Senate Bill 76. First of all, from the Klamath Tribes perspective, we want to say that this has been a long time coming for us. Senate Bill 76 marks the beginning of what we hope will be the end of a long, long process towards getting back salmon to our homelands. The Klamath Tribes lost salmon when the first dams on the Klamath were built over 90 years ago. We're a treaty tribe. The Klamath Tribes ceded to the United States over 22 million acres in order to retain a small reservation for our homeland. So from that standpoint, we look at this as a monumental step towards moving the Klamath Basin and the Klamath Tribes back into a direction where we can enjoy a resource that we had reserved through our treaty. Senate Bill 76 does a number of things, but it really does cap the cost of ratepayers, and we believe it's an excellent deal for ratepayers overall when we think about how we're going to deal with the overall costs of dam removal. Under the relicensing process, we know that costs, if those dams stay in place, will be much higher. They'll be much higher in terms of the fish ladders that are going to have to be built, the screen fish bypasses, the issues surrounding clean water, the severe problems that the reservoirs create with water quality. All of these issues can't be fixed unless we remove those dams. Klamath Basin adjudication is another aspect of this overall deal here. And for the Klamath Basin, we've been dealing with adjudication for over 25 years now. And now we're on the verge of coming to a settlement of the water issues in the Klamath Basin. Senate Bill 76 is a first step in a basin-wide settlement. You've heard already the remarks to the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. The Restoration Agreement has brought together over 26 parties that are mutually supporting and endorsing this agreement. We know it's not solving all the problems of the Klamath Basin, but what it is starting to bring us is some certainty and predictability that hasn't been in that neck of the woods for a long time. We know it's not perfect, but what I can tell you, if we stay with the status quo in the Klamath Basin, we're going to be dealing with this issue for decades to come, and the costs associated with that are going to continue to mount. And it's not just in dollars either. It's in families. It's in livelihoods on both sides, from the top to the bottom. So with that, we urge this committee to support Senate Bill 76. We believe that it marks a new direction for us, the state of Oregon, when we think of these issues. Our culture depends upon fish, and the culture of Oregon is also about fish. Our state here, when you think of it, you think about salmon, you think about the resources that we're blessed with, and we urge that you carefully consider this bill, and we urge that you move it on through.
Thank you. And just to let the committee members know, we're going to go through each of the panels and then ask questions. And we do have a timer. If you go way over, I'll start waving my hand or flag. But I really want to try to make sure we get to hear everybody today and try not to cut anybody off. But I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So whoever wants to go next.
Yeah. Chairman Dingfelder, thank you for having us here. My name is Mike Becker. I'm a coastal resident and a salmon fisherman from Newport. Long time in the industry, and I wanted to take you through not the issues of Senate Bill 76, but actually provide you a little bit of an idea of the economic impacts that the dams have had on the coastal counties and coastal communities of Newport, on the coastal communities on the coast, and put some numbers in the face to it. The Klamath Zone was declared a disaster in 1982, and from that time forward, the Northern California and Southern Oregon coast from Coos Bay south have really borne the brunt of the reduced fishing coming because primarily of the Klamath dams. In 2005, the Pacific Fisheries Management Council declared a disaster and reduced the Oregon salmon fishery by 50%. That year cost the coastal counties in Oregon approximately $12 million. In 2006, they reduced it 90% and cost the coastal counties $28 million, which amounted to about 1,100 family wage jobs. Now, along the Interstate 5 corridor, that may not seem like much, but along a coast that struggles to provide family wage jobs, that's a pretty significant hit. If you go back through the history of the West Coast troll fishery, and I sit back and chuckle, tribal fishermen in the Klamath Basin talk about fishing from the beginning of the time. I have gray hair, but I don't go back quite that far. The two Kopco dams were put on the Klamath River in the 1920s. If you go back through the history of the salmon fisheries, and I'm talking here both sport and commercial and tribal, as many as 3,000 to 5,000 commercial salmon fishermen were fishing in what they call the zone, which was effectively from Coos Bay to Fort Bragg, right in the heart of the Klamath zone. There was a full Indian net fishery in the river. There was a full sport fishery in the river. They couldn't pull those runs of fish down. They were still going very well. In 1958, they put J.C. Boyle Dam on the river, which was the easternmost, and in 1962, they put Iron Gate on, which was the westernmost. Within four generations of fish, 20 years, they declared a fisheries disaster and developed the Klamath Management Zone, which severely restricted all ocean fishing in that 400-mile stretch. The last commercial fishery allowed in that zone was in 1988, and that was 4 days. The sports fishery also was fairly restricted. It culminated in 2005 and 2006. So the losses to the coastal counties coming out of that have been significant, and they go beyond. I'm speaking primarily as a commercial salmon fisherman, but if you look at the impacts that go well beyond that, in the sport fishery, the charter boat industry, the loss of business to the coast coming out of the ocean sports fisheries, it is significant. If you look at our coastal economy, salmon is an icon that is very definitely tied to it. People come to the coast to see our scenery. They come down to enjoy the good, fresh, high-quality seafood that we provide on the coast. And they also come down, if you live in a town like Newport that I do, Depot Bay, Garibaldi, you go up and down the coast, people come down to see the boats coming and going in our working ports. It's an important part of who we are. And basically, we're losing some of that, and it does have dramatic economic impacts for the coast. For those reasons, you know, the coast feels it is really a matter of necessity that those dams come off. It is the only way we can rebuild those fisheries. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Greg Addington. I'm the Executive Director for the Klamath Water Users Association. We represent the interests of Klamath Reclamation Project farmers, ranchers, and irrigation districts. The districts who I represent cover over 170,000 acres and about 1,200 family farms and ranches on both sides of the Oregon-California border in southern Oregon. These are the same people who've been at the heart of some of the most contentious and difficult conflicts in the West in recent memory. I have two what could be perceived as contradictory statements to start off with. One, I'm here today to support the legislation, including the Dash 2 amendments. Second, we love dams. The people I represent depend on irrigation structures, diversions, in fact, up to eight, aside from the dams we're talking about in the Klamath River, up to eight diversions and delivery structures. It's an important component to what we do, obviously. We believe, however, this legislation is critical to providing some stability with respect to the resource and the people in the basin in an area where, frankly, we're known for our instability. I understand you must evaluate this legislation on its merits, and I've heard reference to the fact we should focus specifically on the elements in Senate Bill 76, and I don't disagree with that. But I have to tell you that without the other components that you've heard about, the restoration agreement, the agreement in principle, and what I will refer to as the larger package of those things, without those components, we would not be here supporting this legislation today. It's critical to us that this concept of an integrated package not be lost. We do think this is an element that has to move forward to make the whole thing work, and that's why we're here. I want to just touch briefly on the restoration agreement, and I know that's not what the purpose of this hearing is, but it is related to what we're doing. Related to how it affects the people I represent and my membership, it provides us primarily with a more reliable and secure supply of water, a predictable supply of water. That said, we are decreasing our overall demand, particularly in drier years. We do so without sacrificing our infrastructure or our local economies. The restoration agreement provides opportunity for renewable energy development in the basin and something we can be a part of. Provides regulatory assurances in the form of habitat conservation plans designed to benefit both fish and nervous landowners and irrigation districts. And finally, something that Jeff Mitchell mentioned that should not be lost, certainly on this committee, it settles long-standing adjudication contests between my members, the Klamath Project Irrigators, and the Klamath Tribes. I will try to wrap up here and just say to you that this is a hard thing. Our membership struggled with this. We've struggled with many elements of the restoration agreement, but we've worked very, very hard with, frankly, parties that we only saw on other sides of the courtroom or hearing rooms or in press releases. We've put aside differences. Reasonable parties have tried to come together to form a compromise so that our communities up and down the river can continue to do what we do. With that, I think specifically with respect to Senate Bill 76, I think it's prudent. I think I don't think we would be here supporting it if there was a better alternative for ratepayers. In other words, I think this is the best alternative cost-wise for ratepayers, and so we support it. It seems to come down to, at this point, power generation, public perception, and property rights and the economics for the dam's owner. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is James Honey. I work for an organization called Sustainable Northwest out of Portland. I've had the honor for the last 8 years to be working almost exclusively in the Klamath Basin. My organization's mission is to focus on achieving robust conservation in a context that also allows for the vitality and the resilience of rural communities. So I arrived in the basin in late 2001, naively looking into how can we bring together environmental issues and provide some measure of agricultural stability in the Klamath Basin. I want to talk as a witness to a process that I've both been part of and watched with those here on the panel with me, as well as many of those who are in the room today. And I think that as you consider SB 76, and I do want to touch on a couple technical issues that are part of SB 76, I want to ask you to, yes, do the due diligence on the specific legislation that we're passing, but you have to think of it in the context of what it, the opportunities that it opens for the Klamath Basin. As a result of the process that has moved forward in the Klamath since 2005, the process that brought multiple parties to the table, I was witness to the thousands and thousands of hours that were devoted to trying to come up with these broad set of agreements that allow the basin to move forward. And I want to tell you a little bit about those elements. Moving forward with SB 76, moving forward with dam removal is the cornerstone that allows us to move to the broader set of activities that are necessary economically and ecologically in the Klamath Basin to move it forward. What are the pieces of that Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement? One, incredible that we're all standing here supporting dam removal. Two, the reliability of irrigation deliveries into agricultural communities that are certainly going to do with less, but it's more reliable. On the other side, on the fishery side, we know now, biologists look at it, that the water allocation system worked out in the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement gives some confidence of the return of and the recovery of Klamath Basin fisheries if it comes in connection with dam removal. I don't want to overlook the economic side of this issue. The Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement recognizes, and what brought people together was that concept of sustainability. We're not simply recovering fisheries. We're looking at the stability of communities. So fisheries for tribal communities, fisheries for coastal communities, but we're also looking at the ag community. I think it's pretty remarkable that a number of conservation organizations are working together with the agricultural community now to look at ways that we can address the power issues that have affected both the project and off-project areas in ways that we can help alleviate, if you will, that impact through some economic diversification activities. And then last of all, looking at tribal communities, the folks who have sort of lost the longest, the most for the longest, and also investing in those communities, understanding that their stability is essential. I bring all that up because acting on SB 76 is what allows us to move forward into that broader context, into the broader settlement in the Klamath Basin. To let that go by potentially dooms us to the status quo in the basin. On dams issue, potentially dooms us to 20, 30 years more litigation. The basin doesn't need it. I can also answer a number of technical questions about the legislation. We support the amendments in Dash 2. I've been involved with the Governor's Office, Pacific Corps, a number of tribes and conservation organizations, as well as the Citizens Utility Board, in looking at that language and amending it in such a way that we think works for ratepayers, has the proper public process to consider those issues, but also, again, expediently moves forward with our entire process. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I certainly appreciate many of you came very far to come testify today. Any questions? These gentlemen. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And anybody can answer it. I'm just trying to get a grasp of the situation. Can someone tell me when the agreement in principle was signed? And then I'm assuming that SB 76 was the result of the agreement in principle. And then yesterday, Dash 2, which completely gutted stuffs and replaced the bill, came out yesterday. Can you walk us through the how this transpired?
Yeah, I can give you some dates. Middle of November after, so Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement comes out in proposal January of 2008. The feds, Governor Kulongoski, Governor Schwarzenegger, and Pacific Corps work hard from that point forward. They sign an agreement in principle in about the middle of November of this year. In turn...
08?
Yes. I'm sorry, of last year. Pardon me. I'm still stuck. They signed that agreement in principle in November of last year. The governor then moves quickly with the legislation that you've seen here. Then, over the last several weeks, that legislation was essentially put together, if you will, governor looking at the issue, as that was shared with a broader group of us, including ratepayer groups, had some concerns. We tried to address those, tried to improve it. That's what you see in Dash 2, Senator Boquist.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Mr. Addington, could you illuminate on a phrase you made, which was... more reliability for water users under this. Could you just elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yes, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson. You all know the history. I mean, there's been conflict. There's been water shutoffs. There's been fish die-offs in the river. We're a federal reclamation project. We are regulated, and because of the federal nexus through the Bureau of Reclamation, Section 7 consultation. So we have a situation where the status quo for us is a biological opinion for Upper Klamath Lake and Suckers, a biological opinion for Coho in the Klamath River, which dictates minimum flows. So you have minimum lake levels, minimum flows in the river. And essentially, I mean, the way that our folks look at it is that if there's water left over at that point after those two biological opinions are met, we're then allowed to irrigate. And it's just been, frankly, every year since 2001 when the water was shut off, and really it goes before that. But I've been there going on 4 years now, and last year was the first year we didn't have a near miss. I mean, it was just... month to month, day to day, and when you're farming and trying to plan and do those kind of things, it's very difficult. So when I say reliability, for us it was worth saying we can try to work with less water, an allocation of water based on water year types, if we can have some knowledge early in the season that we're going to lock into a certain supply, even if it's less than we need. We can plan for that. We can manage around that. So the stability of that kind of thing is really important to us.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. I have one quick one since it was brought up, and see if any of you want to comment on the issue regarding sediment. It is not necessarily germane to this bill, but since it was brought up, I'd be curious if any of you want to comment on that. And I'm very familiar with the Marmot Dam removal. Actually watched that happen, and as it was noted, that was actually flushed through the system. So I want to see if there was discussions about how that would be dealt in the Klamath system.
So it is an important technical issue. Let me tell you about how the agreements deal with those and many other unknowns still ahead of us. SB 76, if you vote on it, if it passes, opens a window. We begin to put funds in a trust. We put funds in a trust subject to a determination, a confirmation of the preliminary view of the Secretary of Interior and the wildlife agencies, if you will, in California and Oregon, that dam removal is good for the system. However, the Secretary of Interior will be charged under the agreement in principle with conducting further studies. Those would be the types of issues that would have to be raised and addressed for the Secretary of Interior to then make the decision that dam removal, in effect, does move forward and that we start to access the funds put in the trust. The state of Oregon and the state of California both have a right of review. I believe it's 60 days. I may be incorrect about the day period, but I believe it's 60 days after the secretary conducts his studies and provides his confirmation, his or her confirmation, to look at that again. So we have some insurance systems recognizing that we don't know all of this. It would be fair to say, it would be speculative, but fair to say that if we found some major issue of the proportion of billions of dollars of sediment to be trucked, that would certainly, to me, rise up to the Secretary of Interior as perhaps an issue that would want to have us reconsider. I would also say just this week, the California Coastal Conservancy issued a number of additional scientific studies on the sediments and the sediment management and the impact of sediment. I cannot quote those to you. I was not part of that process. I can give you the summary to some degree was another step in the direction of scientists looking at the issue and feeling that you could move forward safely in the Klamath Basin with sediment management and not unduly affect, if you will, the fisheries. But I think the biggest issue to think about is the mechanics in the agreement in principle and the fact that we look at those issues through the Secretary of Interior's confirmation process.
Okay, thank you. Senator Prezanski.
I actually do want to follow up. Mm-hmm. Based on the settlement, because one of our colleagues has actually raised that issue, as you heard earlier, about how much is there. Do you know if there's been any test as to what type of material that settlement is? We understand that there's some type of, I'll ask my other colleague, a clay that may actually have an effect of basically...
Colloidal?
Is that right? Clay?
Colloidal.
That's beyond my...
Colloidal. It's a geomorphological term.
Right. Good. Thank you.
So there have been sediment study. The California Coastal Conservancy has done that work. I am not the person to quote you on the technical stuff. You can tell my job is facilitative. I spend a lot more time with lawyers than I do in the studies. We can easily provide that information for you. You'd have a sense of the preliminary view, if you will, from the conservation community, from the state of Oregon. I'd also look to my carrier and the work that has been reviewed here in the state of Oregon. We need to make that come to you. I can tell you that, as the Coastal Conservancy has put it out, those preliminary indications are that this could be managed. Okay. Please, I'll be responsible to send more information about that ASAP.
Thank you. You can send that to Beth, and she'll distribute to committee members. Senator Atkinson, another question?
No, actually, comment to Senator Prezanski. The leading sediment study was done by our own Oregon State University, and if our staff could provide the top lines to that study, I think that would be good.
Right.
It was done by Oregon State.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chair, we'll follow up on that. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate
Thank you
coming here today. Have a safe journey back. Okay, next up, and we're going to you see we have a very sophisticated notification system here that my able staff has put together. We have Scott Bolton, Bob Jenks, and Andrea Kelly. Welcome. I'd like to go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. Along with me today is Andrea Kelly, our Vice President of Regulation, and also one of our lead negotiators in the development of the agreement in principle. And I think for the record, this is probably the most senators I've ever testified in front of, so we're breaking the ground. Pacific Corp strongly supports Senate Bill 76 and the Dash 2 amendments. Through the FERC relicensing process begun in 2004, it's become clear that stakeholder parties, the governments of Oregon and California, and the Federal Department of Interior, have all stated a very strong desire for dam removal. And it became very clear to us that as we went through the relicensing process that getting to any kind of settlement that would grant a new license or even working through the traditional FERC relicensing process had a number of risks. When the government comes out and says our preferred outcome is to this process, dam removal, that gave us very strong signals that we needed to start a different conversation. And so understanding the policy positions of the governments and stakeholders, PacifiCorp entered into a settlement framework, now known as the Agreement in Principle, for the potential removal of four dams on the Klamath River, provided that our customers are protected from the costs and risks associated with dam removal. In the Agreement in Principle signed in November 13, 2008, by Governor Kulongoski, Governor Schwarzenegger, and Secretary of Interior Kempthorne, and PacifiCorp, one of the commitments outlined in the agreement is to cap the costs of dam removal that would be borne by Pacific Power customers in Oregon and California to a maximum of $200 million over 10 years. Senate Bill 76 is a rate cost cap bill. This legislation ensures our customers' exposure to the costs and risks associated with dam removal is limited to their proportional share of the $200 million cost cap. So what that means is, in Oregon, we have about 550,000 customers. In California, we have about 46,000 customers. So about 90% of our customers reside in Oregon, 10% reside in California, yet they all bear the same proportional share of the $200 million cost cap. In Oregon, that works out to about $180 million over the 10 years that should be raised through the surcharge and trust account. For the average Pacific Power customer in Oregon, that's about $1.50 a month of rate impact, about $18 a year, and about $180 over the span of the period covered under Senate Bill 76. And let me be really clear in that looking at this surcharge and the cost cap and ratepayer protections outlined in Senate Bill 76, this isn't a choice between $200 million or zero. This is really a choice between $200 million and many, many more millions that could occur under a number of other scenarios, both under traditional relicensing and under protracted litigation over dam removal. Senate Bill 76, at its most fundamental, is a consumer protection bill. We believe it provides a belt and suspenders approach to customer protection, the belt being the hard coding of the $200 million cost cap by this legislature in this legislation, as well as the suspenders, which is the review and oversight of the Oregon Public Utility Commission in implementing the surcharge. This is carefully crafted bill language in the Dash 2 amendments with input from the Citizens Utility Board, the Department of Justice, and the Oregon Public Utility Commission staff. We hope this committee will support the Dash 2 amendments and recognize that the costs and risks of not acting and provide the cost protections outlined in this legislation could have far-reaching impacts, not just for our customers, but for stability in the Klamath Basin. I'd be happy to take any questions, and the really hard ones should go to Ms. Kelly.
Well, we'll hear from Ms. Kelly first. Would you like to add anything, or you're here for questions?
I'm just here to ask a question.
Okay. Actually, Bob, why don't you go ahead, and then I'm sure we'll have questions.
I know I do. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jenks. I'm executive director of the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We're an advocate for residential utility customers in Oregon, and that's a perspective that we bring to this discussion. I'm not an expert on fish, irrigation, a lot of the subjects that this agreement brings in. My role is simply to look out for the customers of PacifiCorp. We had grave concerns with the original version of Senate Bill 96 or 76 that came out. I want to commend the advocates of the bill for sitting down, working with us over the last 2 weeks to address those concerns, and the resolution of that is the Dash 2 amendments, which we support. From a consumer perspective, there's really a couple parts of the bill that really deal with rates and what we're concerned about, and those are the costs that come before dam removal and then the dam removal costs. Section 3 and Section 6 both address costs that will be incurred before dam removal. Section 3 is capital investments. And really what those two sections do is quite frankly, nothing in my mind. I mean, what they do is they mandate that the PUC review these, which the company would file and ask the commission to do, and they mandate that if they're prudently incurred, they would go into rates, and under the traditional cost allocation between various states that PacifiCorp currently operates under. That's exactly what would happen if you didn't pass the legislation. Costs that are incurred of operating the dams before removal, the company will ask for cost recovery of them. If the company can show that they're prudently incurred, they'll go into rates. Oregon's share of those costs will go into rates, and there's nothing this bill does has on those costs before dam removal that are really different than the current regulatory paradigm. To us, the real difference in the bill is Section 4. That's the section that changes rate making a little bit. That's where and Section 4 does two things that is a change from rate making. One, it puts a cap on the dam removal cost. So the $200 million, about $180 million of that is Oregon's share. Obviously, a cost cap is better than a cost with no cap for customers. So that's a positive thing. The other thing it does is it assigns responsibilities to two states rather than the whole territory of PacifiCorp, and that obviously puts our share of the cost to a greater amount. But the important thing for us with Section 4 is that it protects customers by requiring the company to file the final agreement after it's negotiated, along with analysis that shows that that's a customer benefit. And the commission would put in a surcharge but would conduct a process to ensure that rates are just and reasonable. That's a traditional finding. It means the commission would have to look at the final agreement and determine, did the company act prudently, and are these reasonable rates for customers to pay? And that, to us, is what's the most important thing to get in this bill. We don't know whether dam removal is cheaper than the alternative, but that's what the commission process will determine. And again, what we protected was the protection for customers of a commission review and to ensure that this agreement, what happens, is prudent and responsible, and only then can customers pay for it. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions.
Great. Okay. Questions for the panel? Yes, Senator Atkinson, Senator Boquist, and I've got some questions as well. And I think, actually, I've got some questions for Lee Byers, so I'm just going to let him know that he's going to be called up on deck. Senator?
Thank you. Mr. Bolton. Could you articulate just one more time why this would be a good deal for Oregon ratepayers?
Thank you, Senator Atkinson, Madam Chair. Under Senate Bill 76, under this cost cap, you really are looking at, in our view, the lowest cost, best alternative to what could be a very open-ended and expensive FERC relicensing. So the costs, we believe, will go far north of the $200 million cost cap, looking at costs such as fish ladders, capital improvements, fish screens, some of which were mentioned earlier. I think in the FERC EIS, we were looking at $300-plus million just for those costs alone.
Madam Chair, that was my next question had to do with FERC cost. I think a two-part question. One is, I think it'd be good if the company told the committee what you're between as far as FERC timeline and a Senate Bill 76 timeline. And then secondly, we could speak to this. There's concern, right before this, a constituent called, was concerned that Senate Bill 76 created a slush fund that PacifiCorp was going to use to go around the FERC process somehow. I just listened. And that this money wouldn't actually get towards the end result. What safeguards are there to protect the ratepayer from something like this? I mean, I guess the answer really has to do with the PUC.
Sure. This is Andrea Kelly with PacifiCorp, for the record. In response to the second question first regarding the fund, what will happen is we will collect the less than 2% surcharge on customers' bills and remit those funds to a third-party trust that will be designated by the PUC and managed by the PUC. So no funds will be allowed to come out of that trust unless the PUC says it's okay. And so the process for that will either be to remit it to the federal government, to remit it to an agency for or for dam removal permitting, or in the alternative, if one state or the federal government decides that one or more dams can't be removed, then the money would be looked at to fulfill any FERC-required relicensing initiatives. That would, of course, be based on the fact that we would have to have a FERC license to implement those. So that's the first the response to your first question. The second is that under the FERC timeline, we will file with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission an interim conservation plan. and they will be reviewing that interim conservation plan. It has to do with water quality measures and other measures that we will be implementing in the near term. That will be reviewed under the FERC process, and then we will be working through the other processes. The FERC process continues. It's not on hold, but it keeps I think there is time for the parties to continue toward the final agreement and to see if we can get to a final agreement with all the parties. If we can't, then we'll be back in the FERC relicensing process and back to all the litigation and the challenges that we're trying to avoid by working together.
So, last follow-up. So just to finish these three questions up with the fourth. If costs are projected to exceed the cap or the amount of money that would be in the fund, should senators view this as a cost cap protection of ratepayers over the next 10 years rather than an inflation of potential legal risk over the next 20 years? I mean, is that a genuinely good way to think about this bill?
And I'd like to hear from the Citizens Utility Board as well on this, so...
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, not sure I would agree with that paradigm. This is an absolute cost cap. If the, Senator Whitsitt did a very good job, I thought, of enumerating a number of risks and unknowns associated with dam removal. And those costs could go well north of some of the estimates that we've seen now. We don't know. But what Senate Bill 76 does at its bare essence is protect Oregon, Pacific Power's Oregon customers from paying no more than their share of the $200 million towards ultimate dam removal. As far as does this open up other avenues of litigation, again, part of the agreement in principle and what we're working to in final agreement is to ensure that this is one of the pillars that those agreements are built on. And if, indeed, dam removal is in the public interest and the science and economics bear that out, then, again, we've contributed towards that, but no more than what has already been agreed to.
Thank you.
Mr. Jenks?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Atkinson, I would agree with that. We see that as a cost cap for dam removal, and we will demand that the company be held to that cost cap, that the PUC be held to the cost cap, and that the legislature be held to the cost cap. I hope that you folks, if there's a bill 10 years from now to put more money into this, would be very skeptical and said we did what we were asked. The state of California agreed to cover costs above $200 million. Go to them. They have a lot more people than Oregon. They have more of the dams in Oregon. The agreement says Oregon's is the $180 million, and beyond that, California needs to pay. So I would encourage everyone to view that as a cap for cost removal. If we view it as that as we go forward, we're more likely to hold the line on it. I do want to clarify one thing I forgot to mention in my comments when the three-minute sign held up. There's one small error in Section 4. Section 4.4 says that the commission shall conduct the investigation and hearing under ORS 756515. We believe that's the wrong process, that it should be 757210. The 210, 757210 is a process for the company and utility to initiate a filing and the commission to review it, which is what the procedure that's being set up in that section is. So we'd like to see that those numbers, that citation cited to the right process, what we think is the right process.
We'll call up the PUC after that. Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I need to go back to the question they were asking and seek a clarification here. And I guess before, I'm quite sympathetic to the Pacific Corps between a rock and a hard spot, so don't take the question wrong. And Scott and I have talked about this. But you indicated, and we keep saying this is a cost cap. We heard the governor's staff say that, well, if it does exceed 450, you guys are forced back to the table with the state government, with the federal government, and with the state of California to try and figure out what to do next. Okay, so if there's a what to do next, then that's not a cost cap. It's basically an intermediate objective. And so I'm a little confused where it appears to be an intermediate cost cap. We're hoping it doesn't exceed that, but yet I'm looking at the agreement here, and it does say you're going to go back to the table and talk about it. The governor's staff said you're going to go back to the table and talk about it if it's over $450 million. So I'm confused here.
Senator Boquist, I guess the way I would answer that is if we find ourselves in at a moment where the costs or environmental liabilities are such that there needs to be a come together to talk about this, what do we do next? Under the agreement in principle and what's envisioned under the final agreement, that will happen. But again, having Senate Bill 76 in place has already established that the state of Oregon's policy objective is to limit Pacific Power customers' cost exposure to dam removal to their portion of the $200 million. If other parties have to find other mitigations, find other revenues to pay for proceeding forward, then that will be part of the discussion.
This is Andrea Kelly. I would also add that the agreement in principle now states that if the cost of facility removal is to exceed the $450 million, which is the cost cap plus the $250 million, then the United States will not proceed to remove the facilities unless there is an agreement otherwise. So it becomes then the decision path is that they won't be removed unless additional funds can come forward. And obviously we would seek to protect our customers from paying any additional and look then at whether the economics of relicensing make more sense for the customers.
Okay, Senator Metzger, do you have a follow-up
Madam
to that?
Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
I understand what you're saying. I also understand that this has been signed by the Bush administration, and we're now in a new administration. And you made mention that the policy objective is to cap it at $180 million for the state of Oregon, but a policy objective, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't equate to legal liability. If the federal government says we're legally liable or a court says we're legally liable, the policy objective is going to take second seat. Is that not correct?
I think if in negotiating the final agreement, recognizing that it's a new administration, if the economic terms of the agreement to our customers change materially, then the company won't enter into the final agreement. So we still will be conducting analysis and making sure that when we compare the results of the economic analysis of the final agreement, that it still makes sense. That analysis is then what we then need to present to the PUC to convince Mr. Jenks, other consumer groups, that we've made a prudent decision. So, you know, we've looked at a preliminary analysis, said it made sense within the terms of the agreement in principle, but we're still negotiating to make sure that value is retained, and that will be with the Obama administration.
And look, can I add that the actual dam removal costs that we're talking about is Section 4 of the bill. Section 4 of the bill says Oregon customers' share cannot exceed Oregon's allocated share of the $200 million. Now, I read that to say the legislature would have to change Section 4. It's not Pacific Corps that the legislature would have to. The commission doesn't have authority to increase this, to collect more than $180 million from ratepayers under this legislation, in my mind, and I would consider litigating the commission if they did without legislative authority to raise the surcharge above $180 million. So I would argue the legislature would have to be involved in that decision.
Senator Metzger?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to follow up with actually the theme of Senator Boquist, just most importantly for the record. And I certainly applaud you for the work you're doing, and I understand all the principles involved, I think, and I really applaud all the parties for looking at it, you know, objectively and what we should do. But I do want to get back to the cost issue a little bit, and you've articulated what's in there, the 60-day window determined by the feds, the cost exception. But I do want to just drill ahead a little bit so that we as the legislature here in 2009, and the legislature may look back in 2020 and see what the record was there, or the citizens of Oregon or your customers, you know, what the potentialities are, and at least, you know, have that discussion. Because I know in my area of responsibility here, which is transportation, often we do not know until a project starts where unexpected things happen. And I'm thinking of The freeway between Newport and I-5, where we have done a major $180 million project and thought everything was done, all the geotechnical work was done, the project was underway, already committed, and all of a sudden new geotechnical information, we discovered slides, and all of a sudden the cost ballooned and we have to enter negotiation between responsibilities of the state and the contractor. Who's going to pay for this? I mean, we made all the preliminary determinations and everything seemed to be right, but you're already in the middle of the project. So in something like this, you can do all the best work we can possibly do. We can be underway in the project, and everyone's going ahead, and oh my God, you know, we have a cost that's going to exceed. And we have an agreement that says customer costs aren't going to exceed this amount, but there's kind of no turning back at this point. And I just, you know, trying to look ahead to, you know, the unexpected is you can't turn back at that point, so where are those costs going to come from? Is it, and your comments would be helpful on this, and Mr. Beyer make some comments on the PUC's part, but would this be then the customers are going to have to do that because that's, in principle, we have established this as a customer responsibility, or, as Senator Boquist was pointed out, then become a state liability because we have allowed to be entered into the agreement. I'm just trying to wonder where that cost overrun past the point of no return might be borne out, and if you had those discussions on that.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, I think the best way to answer that is that what this legislature is doing with Senate Bill 76 is that on the issue of dam removal, Oregon customers' liability begins and ends with the surcharge that builds up the trust account to go towards ultimate dam removal. That is the universe of responsibility for Pacific Corp's customers, is what this legislature would hard code in the statute as far as our commitment towards this process. Well, as far as operating dams, producing electricity, those are costs that would really be native to the FERC relicensing process and would be what we would normally encounter as a regulated utility providing electrical service to customers.
No, I understand. If I could follow up, just a little bit of care. I understand. What I'm saying is, you've made it very clear in the one point, the customer's liability is this. But if there are costs that have now been incurred that were totally unanticipated and the train has already left the station, you can't stop the dam in mid-removal because we have discovered other things, who then pays that cost? Where would that cost? Who would be asked to, you know, have their bell rung and say, we need more money? You know, you're saying it's not going to be our customers. So what Senator Boquist has pointed out, is that us? Who is the one that has to then, you know, finish the game? And where would that be anticipated?
Well, I think that would ultimately be resolved as the federal government contracts with the dam removal entity. And so there's a non-federal dam removal entity that, through the due diligence process, the federal government will issue an RFP and ask third parties to make a bid on how much it will cost to do dam removal, including liabilities, including those issues. That establishes then the cost that bid is going to require. I think how the liability above and beyond those costs is then between the federal government, who is entering into the contract, and the non-federal dam removal entity. It still has not yet been determined whether the federal government would be the dam removal entity. That's another way to take care of the liabilities so that they don't fall to the state. But those would be fleshed out during due diligence, and that is then why the states have reserved a 60-day right of refusal to say, did the federal government take care of these liabilities sufficiently, or did they not? And if they didn't, we would anticipate that the state would then opt out.
Okay, well, I understand the first part. I'm sorry. I'm talking about after the opt-out provision. I'm talking about when the process was underway, and like our bridge project, you discovered some technical issues that changed the whole cost, and it's already underway. So my understanding is, and just correct me if I understand this right, if these extraordinary costs were to occur after the point of no return, you're saying the federal government's going to pick up that cost or bring it out of the contractor, but it will under no circumstances be the taxpayers of Oregon or the ratepayers of Pacific or in Oregon or California that would pay those additional costs.
You know, I can't speak for Mr. Carrier when he negotiated, but that's my understanding of the expectation, is that this will be dealt with between the federal government and the removal entity at the time the contract goes into effect. I'm not an attorney. I can't talk about
Thank you for not being one.
I can't go.
Hey, we've got one right next door, so it's okay.
I can't get into whether there's no liability, there's no potential for the state to be there, but I know that the folks at the table who are negotiating this and are keeping an eye on it are very mindful of the fact that we can't all say none of us have liability, because ultimately that's not sustainable. So we are looking for a sustainable solution, and I think these are things that we need to take back and make sure are covered off in the final agreement, or it shouldn't be signed by the governments or by PacifiCorp.
And Senator Metzger, I appreciate that excellent line of questioning. I'm going to ask Mr. Carrier to come up and respond to that so we can hear directly from the governor's office. You guys don't go too far away, because I've got some other questions. I know Senator Boquist has another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Mike Carrier, Governor Kulongoski's Natural Resource Policy Director, and I apologize to the company for having to answer many of the questions that really should be the responsibility of the government parties to this agreement to answer, but they've done an outstanding job on our behalf. And the answer is yes. As Ms. Kelly responded to Senator Metzger, it is it has been and continues to be the intent of the state of Oregon in negotiating both the agreement in principle and the final agreement that we will negotiate, that this represent the ultimate cost cap and protection for Oregon PacifiCorp customers. And I want to say that the analogy of Oregon Department of Transportation and Highway 20 is a good analogy with regard to the kinds of issues governments can run into taking on responsibility for projects like this and their dealings with contractors. It's not a particularly relevant analogy in terms of this project, because the contracting entity for dam removal of this project will be the U.S. government. And in the final agreement, Oregon will assume no financial liability or no other liabilities in that relationship that the federal government takes on with the dam removal entity, or that it takes upon itself regarding dam removal. The last thing I want to mention is, of course, there are several phases here where we face risk and determine whether there is undue risk or not. There's the Secretary's determination, which is really a four-year process of addressing Secretary of the Interior of addressing all of the scientific and environmental and risk issues associated with this, to make a determination that we should go forward with dam removal or stop. And the states get a second look at that. That's a point, a very important point, to make that decision about what are the costs, risks, and liabilities to anybody going forward with this. The second point is at which the federal government awards the contract to either a dam removal entity or a contractor to remove these dams. The third point, and you look at the bids and what kind of contingencies or risk factors the contractor may be assigning to that, and that's another decision point. The third point is in the project itself, which is usually the worst time to find out that there are unknown liabilities or costs you didn't expect, or that there will be overruns. And in this particular project, remember, we're removing four dams. One of the determinations the Secretary will make is what is the sequence of dam removal to avoid risk, costs, and liabilities. And it should they be removed in a certain sequence, so that if you determine in the course of removal that there is a significant problem, you can stop the project and still make a decision about whether you then recommission those remaining dams you're not going to remove for hydropower, or retrofit them in the way that they're friendly for fish. We would prefer not to have that happen, certainly, but I'm just pointing out that there are several opportunities for the federal government here to address and deal with that risk without coming back to the states or others and saying, well, now we need more money. Thank you.
Mr. Carrier, while I have you in the hot seat, and then I'll go to Senator Boquist. My understanding is the state of California is going to be seeking bonds to pay for their share of dam removal. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what happens if those bonds for some reason aren't issued? Then are we on the hook, Oregon ratepayers, for paying the remainder of that share?
No, Madam Chair, that's an excellent question, because I mentioned earlier that the legislation for the referral to the California voters has already been introduced, but for obvious reasons hasn't been taken up. And it's my understanding that California is actually going to do this as part of a larger bond measure for a number of water projects that they're going to be doing. Clearly, they've got a number of years for their economic situation to improve before they really have to put that in front of the voters. And it's our expectation that sometime between now and 2012, when the Secretary makes his determination, California will have addressed that. Should they fail to put that in front of the voters by 2012, or should they put it in front of the voters before then and it fails? That clearly gives Oregon pause and an opportunity or reason to drop out of this agreement.
Okay, thank you. Senator Boquist, I apologize for making you wait.
No, not a problem, Minister. Ms. Kerr, in the negotiations, obviously there's been some verbal, but do we have any written documentation from the federal government, signed by someone in the federal government, that indicates that they will consider assuming the additional cost? I didn't say they will, because I don't think we're at that point. What do we have in writing signed by the federal government that says they will consider assuming cost overruns?
We do not have any other documents other than the agreement of principle that you see before you, and we certainly anticipate in the discussions over the next 5 months with the federal government, with the new administration, and with the company and with California, that we, to the best we can, do due diligence on that particular issue. However, I will say that there is a clear possibility of the outcome being that we retain the language we have now, that we will leave it unaddressed until such time as we determine that there is a significant liability, at which point any or all of the parties can just simply opt out.
Thank you. And Senator Brzezinski, you had a question?
I do. Maybe Mr. Kerr's hit part of it. I'm going to call this somewhat the worst-case scenario from my perspective. The bill passes, then at some point it's determined that dams can't be removed for whatever reason, or some of the dams can't be. And then Pacific Corps looks at it and makes a determination for its cost prohibitive to do anything in the way of relicensing the dams. What's going to happen to the dams? What are the options at that point?
Again, I wish
I had a lawyer. The options are uncertain. The likelihood is if the FERC were to provide us with a license, then I'm sure that there's several parties in this room that would begin the Court of Appeals, probably going all the way up to the Supreme Court. If we don't prevail on a license, as I understand it, as I'm informed by my attorneys, we cannot be compelled to remove those dams. We can surrender those dams and initiate a surrender process with the FERC, but frankly, we're in somewhat of a no man's land, and I think that's part of the incentive behind coming to this collective and diverse agreement, is to limit the uncertainty for everybody and try to see a way forward that can work for our customers, but that can also work for the region.
Follow up. So does Pacific Corp have a duty to actually move to relicense? Because what I've just heard mm-hmm. is it sounds like you're taking the position if you go for this license, but I heard earlier that if you all looked at it and said it was economically not feasible, that you wouldn't necessarily seek relicensing.
They can issue a license with a set of terms. The FERC could issue a license with a set of terms and conditions. We have the opportunity then to accept or request different conditions, and all the time Pacific Corp would be operating under annual licenses to do this. Once that process played out, then it could go into the courts, whether we accept that the provisions make sense. And so it just would play out in litigation for years and years and years is how it's been explained to me.
Thank you.
Okay. Last question, and then I have one more question for Mr. Jenks.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for indulging me. Mr. Carrier, if I heard her correct, I think Ms. Kelly said that, you know, one of the options or worst-case scenarios is they could surrender the dams back to FERC. If that transpired, wouldn't it fall to the federal government to remove the dams and assume 100% of the liability?
We could surrender our license,
not the dams.
But what happens to the actual physical dams is absolutely uncertain. Who has the responsibility to remove those, if anybody, is what's up in the air.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I stand by that response. If I were the
God
federal government and the company surrendered its license, I would say to the owner of the dams, these are your responsibility. Yes.
Thank you for that clarification. I do have a question for Mr. Jenks, and I would like to ask Lee Beyer from the PUC to come up if he would be so kind. Could you tell us why the precedent of maintaining the PUCs. Prudency review is so important, and you know, there's been questions about duplicative elements in this bill when the PUC is already required to do that. So I'd like to get on the record, if you can, your views on that.
Okay, Madam Chair, from our viewpoint, that was critically important in this bill, and that was what was lacking in the first round, was commission oversight of the dam removal costs and a commission review of that. I've been contacted regularly over the last 2 years by advocates of dam removal telling me that I should get on board for dam removal because dam removal will be cheaper than relicensing costs. I've seen some economic analysis of that. Quite frankly, none of them have convinced me. I'm not convinced it's not true either. I haven't seen the kind of rigorous analysis that a PUC process will require, a rigorous analysis of the cost of removal versus the alternatives, including looking at all the risks and other stuff's associated with that. It's a good process. It's a detailed process. It's a technical process. And for me to get behind customers paying these costs, that's really what I want. I want to make sure it goes through that process. The company has to file and demonstrate that this is a reasonable, prudent decision, that this is a good deal for ratepayers. And that's sort of been my objection to the original bill and what I asked for and what parties were willing to write to a acceptable level in the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay. Mr. Beyer, thank you for coming here and and lurking in the back today. For the record,
Madam Chair, I'm Lee Beyer, Chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
If you could just comment on the same question that I asked Mr. Jenks.
Let me just say, I've been pushing them to have this review process because of the politics of this. I'm not sure they want it, but from my viewpoint, that's their job. But I this is a highly politicized process, so I'm not sure I'm being welcomed in giving the commission this review.
I noticed that you guys are sitting on opposite ends over here.
That's why I asked.
It was only because Ms. Kelly was here.
Yeah.
Sorry. Madam Chair, I think the answer to the question is the bill as it's written with the Dash 2 amendments puts in place, as Mr. Jenks said, what we would consider from our side is a standard traditional prudence review process. Under that kind of a process, which we do all the time, and any acquisition that a utility would make, we'll be looking to them to demonstrate that the actions that they're taking in this case, dam removal, was the best course of action, the most economic course of action for the ratepayers. And we'd be making a decision about what the appropriate share is under the legislation, as I understand it. That would be limited to Oregon's share of the $200 million.
Okay, and just to follow up, without this legislation, if there was no limit, then...
Well, if there were no legislation requiring the agreement to remove dams, I would assume that Pacific Corps would make a decision whether they were choosing to relicense the dam or take them out, in which case they would still have to come in front of the commission and justify that decision and seek recovery of the cost. Same process as what Mr. Jenks described.
Any other questions for Mr. Beyer while we have him up here? And then I'd like to move on to the witnesses that came over 100 miles.
Senator, thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, what prevents you and the commission from considering to do this without us doing anything? I mean, they're regulated. The utility is regulated by you. Could you not implement 95% of what's in this already, excluding the cap?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I don't think so. As I just said before, I think we react to what the company presents. It's the company's responsibility to deliver power to their customers. How they choose to get that, they make those decisions. We decide whether those decisions are prudent and in the best interest of the customers and what the appropriate amount of money is recoverable in rates.
So if they made this presentation to your commission, you'd have to consider it, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, Senator Boquist, yes, we would.
If I got you fired, I'm sorry.
Okay, any other questions? Senator Atkinson?
Commissioner, you've heard all the testimony, and you've heard all the potential for cost to exceed or cost to be capped. In your estimation, is this a good deal for Oregon ratepayers?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I'm not going to touch that one. I have no information in front of me. That will come, Senator, as part of the prudence review.
Okay.
Nice try.
Okay, Senator Nelson, and then we're going to move on to the...
I was just looking at page 6, I guess, of the signed copy of the Cream of Principle. Let's see, it's the second paragraph from the bottom. It says, the United States determines that the benefits of facilities removal justify the potential costs, risk, liabilities, or other adverse consequences associated with facilities removal, confirming its preliminary view. The United States shall designate a non-federal DRE to remove the facilities. How does that affect all this? Does it have anything to do with any of this?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, to my understanding, what would happen under this is all of this goes to a final agreement. The United States government, and I believe through the Bureau of Rec, would designate a agency or private business most likely to take over the dams and remove them. The PUC's responsibility for that amount of the $200 million that we collect and have in trust, we would then direct the trustee to spend that money as necessary to pay for Oregon's share of removing the dams.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And I apologize. I know this has taken a while, but this is very important information I think needed to be discussed and on the record, obviously, with a lot of questions. But looking forward to hearing the witnesses. I will be calling folks up first who have come more than 100 miles, and then we'll be calling the remainder of the witnesses. And we will get back to our 3 minutes. Apologize that the questioning went on as long as it did. So I will try not to, we'll try to pronounce your name correctly, so I apologize if I do mispronounce it. Catherine Lehman. And then I have, okay. Catherine Lehman, I'm going to call folks up, and it doesn't mean you're all in agreement. I'm just calling you all up, and you'll have 3 minutes each. Steve Condra and Andrea Raby. Did I get that right? Okay, thank you, and thank you for your patience. Why don't you go ahead and please state your name for the record?
My name is Kathy Lehman. I live in Ashland in Jackson County. I am the president of People for the USA Grange with members in both Oregon and California. I'm here today to represent many groups and individuals you were assured earlier do not exist. People in both states who have not been represented in this process and who are unalterably opposed to this dam removal. We have not been allowed to participate in discussion of these issues except as we can now get to public hearings years into the process. I appreciate the opportunity you've given me today to comment on SB 76. I hope you consider my comments as earnestly as they are submitted. I hope each committee member has personally read the draft Klamath River Basin Restoration Agreement released in January of 2008 and the agreement in principle released late last year, as Senate Bill 76 proposes Oregonians fund the proposed removal of 4 Klamath River hydroelectric dams. Said dam removal is inextricably linked to both of these documents. If pursued, this will be the largest dam removal project in the world, necessitating generation of replacement of the project's 169 megawatts of abundant, clean, and by that I mean greenhouse gas-free and carbon-free, renewable and sustainable electricity, serving about 70,000 customers. That is enough clean, green power to serve the combined populations of Eugene and Springfield. Just gone. These agreements, while not yet binding, represent many serious infirmities, such as violations of existing Oregon and California state statutes, existing federal statutes, and even the U.S. Constitution. But too few seem to care about violating the law anymore, so I'm here today to speak for Pacific Corp's ratepayers and as a taxpayer, for it is we who will pay the astronomical cost of this dam removal boondoggle. costs not just for the replacement energy required, but mitigation for the expected environmental and property damage, the loss of jobs, loss of tax revenues to local communities, and other significant impacts I don't have time here to fully address.
Clayman, we do have your written testimony, so I'm just going to ask if you could summarize. Otherwise, I'm afraid we're going to be out of time.
I am, and I will try further. Part of this proposed dam removal will entail the complete destruction of the Iron Gate fish hatchery. If we Oregonians really mean to increase populations in these species, killing off such great production is worse than moronic. The 9,000 acre feet of, I will skip the sediment part that Senator Whitsitt covered earlier, except to say that according to FERC, this $4.5 billion cost to remove the toxic sediment behind the dams will cost nearly $8,000 per electric ratepayer. What the adjusted cost will finally be at the time of actual dam removal, scheduled for somewhere between the years 2020 and 2025, is anybody's guess, but likely to be much higher. Since 2003, federal taxpayers alone have paid over $500 million for Klamath River restoration projects of one sort or another. We have received no identifiable objective benefit, contradicting the best science used to demand the money we spent. Salmon is still so abundant throughout its complete range that I paid as little as $1.99 a pound for wild Chinook salmon on multiple trips to a local supermarket in 2008. Additionally, this Klamath settlement agreement, if this is all approved, will cut a 30,000 acre foot irrigation diversion to the Callant Irrigation District that my husband and I have subscribed to for over 40 years. This will completely shut down the operation of the Callant Irrigation District and will cut 25% of the irrigation water to all of the Rogue Valley. So please do not pass SB 76 out of committee.
Thank you
for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Steve?
Committee, Vice Chair, my name is Steve Candra. I'm a Klamath Irrigation Project farmer and irrigator. I have served 24 years as a director on irrigation districts in the Klamath Irrigation Project, both in the states of Oregon and the states of California. My farm straddles the border, so I have that privilege. I will tell you from the strife that you have seen over the last decade, my farm and my constituents are ground zero in that conflict. We are extremely motivated for what I would call a collaborative solution to the water supply problems, the cost of energy, and regulatory assurance. I will tell you that my constituency bears the brunt of regulatory assurance on the Klamath River this state. I will tell you, too, that we are also what I will call customers of PacifiCorp. On my farm and on districts that I help manage, we have tens of thousands of horsepower and kilowatt hours that we use. And so we are very interested in support Senate Bill 76 because it is a practical way for us to control the risks and control the costs as ratepayers and of PacifiCorp. So it's just a good business decision for us to deal with that problem. Also, Senate Bill 76 is a complementary component of a greater restoration program within the valley that will, I call in decades and years and generations of strife that we all have enjoyed or not enjoyed. I will tell you that if you look into my history, I'm one of those fellows that I've litigated, I've sued, I've done the media wars, not very productive. We are falling to a point where we have a collaborative process within the environmental community and the irrigation community that we have a vision in sight and solution to our problems. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Candra. Ms.
For the record, it's Andrea Robbie. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and committee members. I address you today as an off-project irrigator. My family runs a family farm. I have four kids that I hope to one day be able to pass on the farm to with reasonable power rates and water assurances. We've come before you on a number of occasions regarding the different aspects and issues that have come forward with the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. Although you've heard that we might get a predictable water supply out of it, we might be able to make renewable energy that will offset what we lose with the dams, and that it will settle adjudication issues, I'm here to tell you, as an off-project irrigator, it does not resolve any of those issues for my ranch. It does not resolve, the way it is currently written, the adjudication issues between the off-project irrigators and the Klamath tribes. We are having discussions, aside from the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, to settle those water disputes and also to avoid potential litigation as we move forward in the Klamath adjudication. It does not guarantee me a predictable water supply, as we have not settled those adjudication issues. And furthermore, my energy costs are still going to go up as a Pacific or rate payer if we remove the dams and we put that cost back onto a rate payer. I'm going to be paying there. So not only am I losing my water potentially, I'm also potentially losing affordable power. Without having a way to replace that, the viability of my farm for long term, to turn that over to my four children to someday run as their own family farm, is really disappearing quite quickly. I would say today, too, I think we need to focus on what the question is. In my mind, the question here today is not whether or not the dams are coming out. But the question is, if they come out, who is going to pay for them, and at what cost, and with what liability? And if we keep the focus on that, as an off-project irrigator, I'm going to be paying the cost as a ratepayer. There's some dispute here as if those cost overruns occur, who is responsible for that? As an Oregon taxpayer, I would again be responsible. Or, as a federal government taxpayer, I would again be responsible. I have some very serious concerns that the Oregon ratepayers and then potential taxpayers are going to be shouldering the burden of dam removal, that if potentially it's seen as the best alternative for fish passage, maybe we should look at it across the state or across the United States as a pain, instead of going straight to the ratepayers that are already burdened with a number of other issues facing us today in our agricultural production practices. Thank you.
Thank you. I apologize for being out of the room. I have to take care of some business. So, any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much for coming here today. I know you drove far, and we appreciate it, and certainly we'll review the written testimony as well. Okay, next up, we have Glenn Barrett. Dr. Richard Garrick, am I saying that right?
Correct.
Okay. And Rex Cozzaglio. Oh, no. Well, you know, with my name, I'm very sensitive to pronouncing it right. So, okay, thank you. Why don't we start? You look like you're ready to go, so why don't we start with you?
Well, I'll be happy to go ahead and speak first. Basically,
and can you state a reminder, state your name for the record.
Dr. Richard Garrick. I represent Interactive Citizens United, a property rights organization, and, quote, landowners down on the Klamath River itself. Basically, I hold degrees in biology, chemistry, and a doctorate in healing arts. I was a member of the FERC Fish Passage Advisory Team and the Hatchery Evaluation Team in 2001 and 2002. And based on those protocols, I find that the integral nature of the KBRA and the AIP are basically documents that have totally left the public out in violation of NEPA and FACA. So basically, you can expect, or they can expect, before this agreement finally comes to a conclusion, we already are investigating attorneys, because this is not allowing the public to truly be involved with this process of the AIP. Nowhere within the protocols of the AIP document do they really show any true measure of restoring salmon. I find that this is rather interesting, because basically that's what they want to do. The lower the temperature of the Pacific Ocean by 3 degrees would do the job. Unfortunately, we can't do that. You can change the mitigation protocols at all of the hatcheries, and for the sustainable document, which I will go ahead and pass on because it's too long to read, you can increase your salmon production from the Klamath River quadruple within the first 4 years, and a lot further than that in the next following years. Should be of interest to know that the largest historic run of salmon on the Klamath River occurred in 1938, many, many years after the dams were in place. The estimated cost of the project, I think we've already heard enough about the sediment. We understand that they took core samples all of 4 inches or even 4 feet deep out of a sludge layer that estimated to be much deeper than 40 feet. If you want a true toxic analysis, you're going to have to get to the bottom of that sludge layer. I mean, let's face it, the miners use mercury, and we have other toxic chemicals that have been dumped into that river since the 1800s. And this has all got to be laying there. Very expensive process. Plus, it will create an ecological disaster if you remove these dams or even put in fish ladders. You have a total ecology system that sits above the Iron Gate Dam now and hatchery that has been in place for 100 years. Salmon carry viruses, bacteria, fungi, and parasites that they have not been shared with these other critters in this nice ecological region. You put a fish ladder in and put these new diseases up there, it could be a total disaster. One last point that I'd like to make here is basically we hear about how things have changed so drastically. Since 1950 through the year 2000, the average number of takings of salmon landed in Alaska was 40% of the total catch. In Oregon, the total average was 17%. In Washington, 23%, and in California, 20%. In 2006, the latest National Marine Fisheries Service numbers indicate of the annual catch, Alaska had 62% of the annual catch, and Washington has increased to 25%, while Oregon and Washington fell below 10%, showing clearly that the warmer waters have driven the salmon north. Leave the dams in place. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for driving here today.
Pardon?
Thank you for coming here today, such a long
My
distance.
Pleasure.
Chair Dingfelder, thank you for...
it's okay.
I did that last time.
Goes all to always.
Congratulations on your Senate appointment.
It's sort of just like it.
The last time we met, you were over on the representative side, so congratulations. My comments will be brief. Philosophically, I just find it really hard to take away...
Oh, yes. Could you state your name for the
Glenn,
record, please?
Glenn Barrett.
I was distracted by the name thing, you know.
My name's Glenn Barrett, past president of Water for Life. I'm also a rancher and livestock producer in the Klamath Basin within the project. And philosophically, I would just like to say I find it really hard to remove power-producing facilities that are eco-friendly and green power, and change our infrastructure of Oregon to other power sources that may well be outside of our region and cost much more. As well as you've heard in the previous speakers, I'm really, really concerned about the overrun potential and the cost that it might come not only to the ratepayers. Yes, this is a ratepayer cap legislation, but what happens to Oregon taxpayers as well? And I think before this moves forward, you really need to flesh that out to deal with those overruns and who really is liable for that. The other issue you've heard today is about the restoration agreement. And this is a really hard issue to deal with. I have some really good friends within the project that fully support this, and rightfully so. I think it does probably provide some protection of water deliveries within their ring. Or realm of the situation here. But you got to also remember, as we're dealing with Oregon legislation, half of the land, or close to half of the land on the Oregon side of the border, is without those protections, and that's above the project. And I would like to see better protection and better equity for those lands that receive irrigation So we aren't setting in place a process in which we end up hurting Oregon production agriculture and sending it on down to California for the water. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Rex Gazzaglio. I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak here today. Thank you. Our family is located at perhaps the best location to determine the dam impacts below Iron Gate and above any confluences. With four generations in that location, with ties prior to the Klamath Project and the dams, and personal experience before and after Iron Gate, I am in the water over 50 times per year for over 50 years as my grandfather before me. I can unequivocally state the water quality, quantity, riparian stability, algae, and even temperatures are better now than before the dam. I could regularly walk across the river in late summer without getting wet. In spite of the rhetoric, there are physical facts. By the time the salmon reach our property, they are virtually dead. Retired Iron Gate hatchery managers estimated the best salmon have reserves to reach Copco before dying. In spite of what they claim, we live the repetitive floods and riparian devastation prior to mediation by the dam. Coho never existed in our mid-stem until the marginal third attempt at planting after Iron Gate was built. There have been no definitive scientific connection between dams and coastal regulation shutdowns. Tremendous numbers of salmon leave the Klamath every year. With salmon never known to go in numbers above the present Copco location, when dams are removed, the failed actions will move upriver. To date, the many proven cost-economical options have been ignored. The AIP puts into place unjustified costs upon the ratepayers that will not disappear when the purpose fails. With the AIP in place, whether or not dams are determined to stay, those costs will actually compound, and the Klamath Basin will suffer, creating a second blow of added enforcements the public will bear. Assurances of conflict resolution through the AIP are obtained through unrepresented asset reallocation, placing the burdens upon the ratepayers and the public with no assurance of success and no consequence of decision, destroying an asset to force a settlement, discarding a majority of vested interest against dams removal is not the answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witnesses? Senator Nelson.
Right, I just one of these things that I read here said that in 1827, when Peter Ogden was on the Klamath River below the present-day Keno, the Indian guide said salmon didn't come up here because of the falls and the rapids. Could you explain that? What does that all mean?
Actually, that wasn't my submission, but that is true. I do have some historical information in it as well. Related to that, but that is very true. Before, of course, Keno, without being removed, is not exposing those falls and impediments again, but the lake itself is a far greater surface area. All of the lakes and water bodies are shallower, wider surface area. The Copco and Iron Gate reservoirs are the deepest, coldest, and smallest surface area water bodies in the entire chain. With them being removed in the historical knowledge, the records of what salmon from the area were impeded from going to into water quality that historically they're saying was not conducive, it won't be changed. It won't be eliminated. Are they going to go to alter the natural occurrences of Klamath Lake, Upper and Lower, Lake Juana, Tule Lake in order to try and change those? No, they're creating larger marshes of shallow water that they're saying are going to filter the water. That's actually the effect that the dams have had. We've lived through it, have seen tremendous improvement. The request was by most of the people, while it was considered by some of the community, by government facilities, that fluctuation mitigation from COPCO was part of the reason the majority of public in the area needed it, wanted it for provision of additional water in late summer to maintain flows throughout and to minimize the devastation, riparian devastation that occurred virtually every year from flooding, that the others were not possible of mitigating. They're opening up a can of worms that our forefathers actually improved the environment by creating. Interestingly, with no real disregard or no real, excuse me, contention. That's the word I needed. I'm getting old. With no real contention at the time they put in COPCO from any of the parties involved, including the tribes.
Other questions?
Thank you so much. Rex, as somebody who's lived on the river, your family's lived on the river for four generations, do you have an opinion what would happen to the sediment behind those dams if the dams were just removed? Would they? Do you think the sediment would stay there, or do you think it would come on downriver?
Our soil is basaltic clay in our region. My grandfather used to call it, when it was wet, it was brown water. While it doesn't accept water when it's dry, when it's actually soaked and it has no cover and no stability, root stability, it actually turns fluid and it will transport down. It's going to mix it as extremely small, fine particles and nanometers in size. The sediment concerns me greatly, especially for the near-term impact. But frankly, that is only part of the concern. In our history, what we know of the river with it going dry, with the drought-prone area that is part of our our nature of our country as high desert, what will happen when they're removed? All options are taken away. There is no, right now they can do testing, they've done studies, I've been witness to many of the experiments and manipulations which under the current best science, I'm sorry, all of them have failed. And they're saying, well, yes, but we've learned from that, we'll fix it and we'll do the next best thing. The trouble is, they aren't. Once the dams are removed, there is no going back. And at that point, the damage is done. There is no alternative upon shutdowns. I don't care how many agreements are in place. With a hierarchy being established with the AIP, with the total authority, basically, I'm sorry, with the Interior Secretary, which it grants, and it does not put a limit on the amounts or the assessments that they can put on the ratepayers and the taxpayers. With all of that power in place, they'll have essentially one option to shut down the water system. It'll shut it down to everybody that's there. And all of the alternatives. I went to Washington with the Siskiyou Board of Supervisors trying to present the alternatives that have been proven at far more economical rates than what they're considering here in order to accomplish a settlement. They were rejected because everyone is in support of sacrificing the dams in order to promote a settlement to a small group of people while actually segregating the majority that are against the removal, who have a history, who recognize that that is the worst thing for the Klamath environment they can do.
Okay. Any other questions? We have a lot of witnesses that would like to testify and want to make sure we get to hear them as well. Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming so far today. Okay, next up is Becky Hyde, Carl Skrantz, and Roger Nicholson. Thank you all for coming. Again, please, reminder, state your name for the record. Thank you, Senator Nelson, for joining us. Okay, why don't you go ahead and get started since you took the chair first.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Dingfelder and committee. It's very good to be able to talk to you. I'm Roger Nicholson, and my family has been irrigating farmers and ranchers in the Klamath Basin since the 1890s. I lead a group that represents well over 100,000 acres in the upper Klamath Basin, as well as all, except I think one, of the contestants and the participants in the present adjudication. We represent all of them except one individual. And anyway, several comments that I'd like to make about Senate Bill 76, specifically about it, and then I would like to also talk about the restoration agreement as it is tied, as you've heard other speakers speak. We are a group that likes dams, and we like the Klamath River dams, and we'd like them to stay there. They provide affordable power. They provide many environmental benefits. And we do not believe that any evidence can be provided that salmon were ever in our area. It's not reestablishing a salmon run. It is trying to establish a salmon run. And nowhere have I ever seen evidence to the contrary to that. A big concern of our group is not only the increase. We hear Oregon, I'd like to, it's sort of a misnomer, if you will. Oregon ratepayers are going to pay this. It's a select group of Oregon ratepayers. It isn't the whole state of Oregon that's Pacific Power's customers. It is a select group. A whole lot of Eastern Oregon, for example. A whole lot of economically disadvantaged people. We're not the affluent area of the state. We hurt. We're hurting big time with the present day economy. I think nobody has really addressed that. Sort of unconscionable to talk about increases of production costs and so forth in today's world. But as well as the decommissioning cost, I think something that hasn't really been explored is the cost of replacement power. It's a double whammy. It just isn't decommissioning cost. It's huge, the cost of green power and reestablishing green power. I'd like to, while I still have a little time, address the water issues. We were the group who tried to participate within this restoration agreement and were denied access to it. It was a closed door, had no transparency whatsoever. Lacking, I've heard other speakers talk about violation of open meeting laws and so forth. I don't know if it was or not, but the fact I know we were denied access. As the representatives from an area, a very, very large area of irrigated lands. I'd just like to, and by that not in representation, I'd like to briefly compare ourselves with those who did get to participate. They got a predictable supply of power. We've lost 100,000 acres to government purchase, plus another guaranteed 30,000 acre feet, just a beginning, another 30,000 acre feet of reduction. Renewable power, they got a source, an ability to get affordable power. We had no access to affordable power. As well as I might add that they are now applying for a process that will even take them out of the Pacific Power realm where they won't pay any of that. In closing, I would like to say that state adjudication issues, theirs were settled. We have to go ahead and litigate ours. And I think in closing, I'd also like to say, follow the money. Project users are receiving $10 million a year for 10 years for this process. Instead, we receive a high attorney bill to go ahead and finish the adjudication where we would have liked to have settled these issues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Carl Srantz. Thank you very much for letting me speak. I'm a farmer from Klamath Falls, Oregon. I'm a third-generation farmer. I have farmed in both project and off-project, the Upper Basin, and currently just in the Upper Basin outside of the federal project. I'm president of the Upper Klamath Water Users Association. It's a 501c6 organization, and it's a newly formed organization that we have created, and our goal is to work within the settlement agreement group and work for protections for the Upper Basin irrigators. We support Senate Bill 76. My area of expertise is not dams, and I know that's what this is specifically geared for. But like I had said, we our goal is to work within the restoration parties and get some things, and I'll list the three things that we feel necessary for off-project upper basin irrigators to participate in. One's water assurances. We would like to limit land idling and promote conservation measures to the best of a possibility. On my farm, I have drastically reduced the amount of water usage. I know it can be done, and I support any conservation goals as opposed to just just land retirement to do away with water for farming. Another is participate in the power grow program. There's an organization called Klamath Water and Power Agency being created. It's a government agency. Our goal is to have our organization tie on to that organization so people in the outside of the federal project can participate in all the things in that program would be renewable energy production, promote irrigation efficiencies whenever possible, and also take advantage of tax credits. And then also, the number three goal is protection from Endangered Species Act and Clean Water Act issues. I know that that's impossible to do to 100% degree. We can't guarantee that those assurances. We must just live with those realities. With our coalition, but the way I feel, working within a coalition where you have irrigators, tribal members, environmental group, and company, the Pacific Core company members, I think we can work on those issues together. And my position is that we would all support each other if there were problems arose, and we could work through those problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sharns. Ms. Hart? And then we'll take questions for everybody.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Dingfelder. I'm very happy to be here and appreciate you guys listening. My husband's family has ranched in the Upper Williamson for 100 years.
Could you just state your name?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm
for the record,
slacking here as a
Becky
chair.
Hyde. My husband's family has ranched in the Upper Williamson for almost 100 years, and my husband and I also have a ranch with our four children on the Sycan River near Beatty. And I think I have the I should just wear a badge of failure honor, because I think I've been involved in almost every water settlement attempt we've tried to do in the Upper Klamath Basin for the last 10 years, and we've had a lot of failure. And I think that this Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement is our best chance to help bring stability to the ag community that I love. Having said that, there are issues that Roger Nicholson mentioned in our community that need to be addressed within this KBRA agreement, especially around water security for the OFF project and trying to work through settlement with the Klamath tribes in the adjudication, as well as clarity around attaching ourselves to the entity called QAPA, which is what the project irrigators have worked hard to put together for power, and also to do whatever we can to ensure that landowners have the best regulatory security under law available to us through this agreement. So there's a group of us that have created a new entity called Upper Klamath Water Users. We are trying to work within the KBRA framework, even though we understand that there are holes in that are affecting our future. So we're working actively with the tribes, not only the Klamath tribes, but other tribes in the basin. We are working with the project irrigators, because we also have water settlement issues with them. And we're just doing our best to come up with solutions that get us to where we need to be. So, and I also wanted to note that I also sit on the board of the Klamath Watershed Partnership. I believe our board is 18 members right now. And back, I can get this to you so that it's accurate in the record if you would like. The Klamath Watershed Partnership voted to support the restoration agreement back in February with, I think, two dissenting votes on the board. And that group does represent, you know, the upper basin, a lot of the different communities.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair, question for you.
Senator, what's up?
Senator, Vicki, you and I worked together on the Shiloh meetings years ago.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I believe I burped your third baby a couple of times.
Yeah, fourth baby.
Okay. And actually, that effort was primarily aimed at preventing the Bureau of Reclamation and the Commissioner from downsizing the Klamath project at that time. And as you recall, they wanted to take off the outside of the project and just keep the inside, which would have been the Shasta View project and all that sort of thing. This KBRA downsizes the off project by 30,000 acre feet of water. Would you comment on that dichotomy?
Yeah, I think that. Thank you for asking, Senator Whitsitt. The KBRA does propose right now a voluntary reduction of 30,000 acre feet in the off project, which is the community that I live in, Carl is in, and Roger Nicholson and others that spoke earlier, Andrea Robbie, the concerns that Glenn Barrett had. That is that community. I think that there was a seat at the table for the off project community under power, and I'm sure the folks that are part of that are here, Tom Mellums and others will testify. But there wasn't a seat around water, and part of that is because there was it started out as a FERC process, so all of us waterheads didn't necessarily think we needed to be in a dams process. So it sort of took over and became then the place where settlement was trying to happen in our basin. And if you want to have a glass of wine with me and spend all evening letting me tell you this story from my perspective, we could do that. But the long and short of it is that settlement has sort of moved through that basin over time in fits and starts. So the 30,000 acre feet that Senator Whitsitt is talking about has to do with what they've come up with for water balance that they think fish need for downstream flows, what the project needs, and what the off project might contribute. It does when folks talk about how much the off project has given in the past, they're absolutely right. There has been a tremendous amount given already out of the off project community where I live. It's a complicated it's not easy to just give a snap answer on this, because we have a lot of folks who have extremely junior water rights in the off project, and as we move towards the realities of adjudication, it puts some of our futures in a pretty risky state. So to make a snap comment on the 30,000 acre feet would be sort of irresponsible. I think what we need to do is be working as hard as we can to bring stability to that ranching community.
Just
thank you.
A short follow-up.
Becky,
how much land is under this KBRA? How much land under irrigation would the project irrigators give up?
Well, I would love to have a project irrigator respond to that, and I think it depends on the year type. But if you'd like to have somebody from the project come answer that, I'm sure they would be willing if there's someone here.
We'll make sure that we get that information
sure,
to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you all for coming here today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I appreciate you coming far. I think we have one more person I think that is over 100 miles, Tom Mellums. Is Tom here, Mr. Mellums? Okay. I thought maybe you gave up on us. Anybody else?
Did Ambrose cross off?
Ambrose. Is there anybody else that came here from over 100 miles? Okay. Anybody else? Come on up.
Can't forget Ambrose.
Come on down. Price is right.
That's yeah. Right.
Well, he didn't.
He didn't say 7 o'clock, right, Madam Chair?
Six. He didn't close it off there, so I didn't know why. Okay.
Are we doing three or gone both?
Who wants to start? How about you? You look like you're all ready to go. Just a reminder to state your name for the record, please.
My name's Ambrose McAuliffe. I'm from Fort Klamath. I'm appreciating the opportunity to speak before you.
Well, thank you for your patience.
I started irrigating in our little town back in 1958. So I have had a little experience as far as the use of water. We irrigate pasture land and try to raise what we consider some of the best, highest protein probably in the United States, maybe even beyond. Fort Klamath is famous for that high protein grass the basin in general has that reputation, but we are special. Always have felt that, and I was sitting here thinking, I've got to come up with something maybe that isn't repetitious or that you haven't heard. And I hope I don't I won't drag this out, but I hope I don't embarrass myself or you either one. But I'm going to take a shot at it. And one thing that I think has been overlooked that's really important to this discussion, have you heard of the Trinity River and how that water was diverted in 1960 by the Lewiston Dam into the Sacramento system? I'm sure you're familiar with that. But in dimension, we're talking 18 feet diameter, 4,000 CFS. And that was the cold water supply for the lower Klamath. Over a third of the flow for the lower Klamath historically came out of the Trinity. After that diversion, it wasn't too long before you could walk across the river. The willows are growing in it. So taking that into mind, fast forward to a conversation I had with a businessman in Klamath Falls who has a houseboat on Shasta Lake, along with a number of other boat owners. If you had the opportunity, it would be, might be well worth your while to take a little drive down there and see what a bunch of beached houseboats look like. And it would make you kind of gasp because these folks don't know what they're going to do. But what actually did happen, I said, what? Nobody was prepared for this. You know, it was like a freak. This is an unusually dry year, we'll say. But no, he said, Department, the Bureau of Reclamation, they sold 40 foot of that water to L.A. So, obviously, you know, situations change. We're talking global warming. We're in a drought. Everybody's aware of that. But when you go down into the state of California, I mean, there's a lot of desperation, not just here in Oregon, but it's just something to keep in mind. The value of what we're talking about and how it can impact a lot of our decisioning or should be considered. It should be a very grave consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for listening to our comments. My name, for the record, is Tom Malams. I'm president of the Klamath Off-Project Water Users Association. We are a power group that was formed originally when the FERC processing first started up because there wasn't, as someone else said, there wasn't an issue of water at that time. Our group has been at the table since the beginning. Like I said, we are a power group. We don't get involved in the water issues. We're not supposed to get involved. Our organization is strictly for power. We have had a seat at the table. Myself, personally, I'm a small business owner. I have a fairly small ranch. We grow hay and grass. We struggle like everybody does. This Senate Bill 76, I think, has a potential to break a lot of people. There's been numbers said to how much it's going to cost the average ratepayer. I think somebody said $1.50 a month. I don't believe that for a second. You know, the numbers we've run are way astronomically or higher than that. And this economic times we're in right now, to set additional costs to individuals that are on a set budget, so like retired people or those disabled people or anything like that, or small businesses that struggle to meet their business needs, that can have a catastrophic effect on them. This is only supposed to go for 10 years, but I see it going for a lot longer than that, possibly. The possibility of the sediment issue on the dam removal part has been just an absolute horrible mistake, I think. This is a classic case of putting the cart before the horse. They should have had those studies done, completed way before the AIP was signed. How can you start pushing legislation and raising rates on people when you don't even know what the cost is? They mentioned the sediment issues. I know there's been sediment studies done out there. I've seen two of them. There are toxic materials there. There absolutely is. The testimony here has been that that will go down the river, and that's going to have massive fish kills. Some people even think that it could sterilize the system, some of the fish habitats, the spawning grounds. They say, well, that can add gravel back to it. Well, some of those toxic materials in there, they stay in that in those reaches of the river, and they may not be able to get them out once they go in there. That may destroy the fish habitat instead of improve the habitat. Going back to the, I know this is wanting to focus on the Senate Bill 76, but we have to talk a little bit about the KBRA. Some of them mentioned already the 30,000 acre feet that's going to be sacrificed up in the off-project area in my area. That's only a beginning. That is worded as an actual measured inflow into Klamath Lake, an additional 30,000 acre feet of inflow. If they have, if those numbers aren't reached, they will go after more water. That's just a simple fact. We have already idled over 100,000 acres of land in the off-project area already. There's another bunch here, and there will be additional land have to be idled because they can't meet that 30,000 acre feet with what they're trying to do right now. I appreciate your position. You're in a very awkward position here. I hope you will take into consideration all these facts of the upstream Upper Basin people. We do have a very unified group in our off-project water users group. The other group that has been recently formed, they've already spoken. I think they do have a right to their opinion, absolutely. They represent a handful of people by their own admission. They were formed back in October. Ours has been informed back when it first started out. We have somewhere in the area of like 300 people. So, and we are very, very unified. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Could you state your name for the record?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Craig Tucker. I'm the Natural Resources Policy Advisor for the Cudahy Tribe. The Karuk Tribe is a fairly recognized Indian tribe, the second largest in California, although we do have many members in Oregon. And we're the tribe immediately downstream of the dams. And what I want to do is go through some of the points being brought up today that I think misrepresent the reality of the situation. And so I want to go through a quick tick list. And the first is this: there's been a challenge that salmon historically lived above the dams. There's a paper by Hamilton et al. That was published in American Fisheries Society, a peer-reviewed journal, the most prestigious fisheries journal in America, that shows that salmon, steelhead, and Pacific lamprey went as high up in the basin as the Williamson, Sprague, and Wood Rivers. There's photographic evidence. There's tribal oral histories. You can read the diaries of Kit Carson and Jedediah Smith, where they rolled into Indian villages in the upper basin, killed the Indians, and took dried salmon with them. It's well documented. There's also been a challenge that there's no scientific evidence that dam removal is the best thing. That's not true. FERC's final EIS summarized the science, and FERC concluded that dam removal was the best alternative to restore the fishery, and that dam removal was the best alternative to repair water quality in the Klamath River. Someone mentioned that the KBRA would affect irrigation diversions to the Talent Irrigation District. That's not true. I'll be willing to meet with folks and confer and go through the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement and point that out. There's been a lot of discussion about the sediment, and I would charge that the fear that the sediment is going to be some sort of disaster is a red herring. There's been two studies on the sediment, both by the California Coastal Conservancy, who hired Stillwater Sciences, the same folks who did the sediment study on Marmot Dam. As folks familiar with Marmot Dam might know, that the hydrologists predicted exactly what was going to happen when they took out the dams. That same hydrologist did the sediment analysis for the Klamath. They have come up with the rate of drawdown for the reservoirs based on core samples taken from behind the dams. They look at the size of the sediment. Their analysis is that about a third of the sediment would be transported downstream, and they would all reach the ocean. The sediment is non-toxic. The gold mining that's going on in the Klamath Basin went on downstream of Iron Gate Dam. When you remove dams, you have to fear of mercury in the sediment behind dams where there's been gold mining operations, because the basin above Iron Gate is a volcanic geology. There's no gold up there, and so no one ever gold mined up there. Furthermore, the structure of the agreement in principle will require that the Secretary of Interior do a further analysis. My client is the guys who live downstream. If there's a toxicants in the sediment or the sediment's going to create flooding or other problems, we're going to be the first guys who show up and say, don't remove the dams. So we are concerned that there be due diligence done on the sediment, but we think the science is there. And people keep raising the specter of uncertainty when it comes to costs. And people say, well, what if you try to remove the dam and it costs a lot more than you think it will? Well, SB 76 caps Pacific Corps' Oregon ratepayers' contribution. But what if you relicense the dams? You're mandated to build fish ladders. A fish ladder at Iron Gate Dam, 173-foot-tall dam, would be over a mile long. What if the cost of that gets spiraled out of control? The California Energy Commission's high-end estimate of implementing the mitigation measures for a new license is $470 million. If that spirals out of control, it is going to be Pacific Corps' customer base that's on the hook to pay for that. So you've got two alternatives. Status quo is not an alternative. If you relicense the dams and try to fund all the 160 mandated mitigation measures, plus the yet-to-be-determined mitigation measures for water quality, I think the cost, you run the risk of a lot higher costs. And then finally, people keep talking about green power. Well, if you noticed, Mr. Bolton's had this beautiful green tie on today. Well, that's about the color of Iron Gate Reservoir and Copco Reservoir in the summer because of massive blooms of the toxic blue-green algae Microcystis aeruginosa, the highest blooms ever recorded in the world. So already we have signs up and down the river in the summer telling people not to touch the water because it's toxic. We already have a toxic disaster on the Klamath River, and that's what we're trying to fix. Thank you.
Thank you. And could you just restate your name and who you represent for the record? Because I think
I'm Dr. Craig Tucker. I work for the Kadarook Tribe.
Okay. That's what I thought. Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question.
Witnesses.
I'd just like the doctor to send us the historical data and the science reports, and I'm assuming you're from the state of California, right?
I am indeed, and I'll be happy to send that to you.
Yeah, we're going to have it sent to our staff administrator, and she'll forward it to all the committee members. Senator, what's it?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. A couple questions. One for Tom Malams. Regarding the 30,000 acre feet on above the lake, can you kind of describe to the panel so they can understand that how long and flat and tortuous the Sprague River is and how many times that water is used? So to actually flesh out why the difference between just 30,000 acre feet of water and as it's used and 30,000 acre feet of water put into the lake.
Yes, the 30,000 acre feet of water that's supposed to be retired through this voluntary buyout, that's going to put it's going to decimate our area very much so, because a lot of our water gets reused numerous times through return flows. When you retire, a person's acreage, and if you live next door to that person and you irrigate your property, it's then going to take you twice as much water to irrigate your property because your neighbor's is dry. It's called a sponge effect. So as you dry up more land up there, it's going to be harder to meet that 30,000 acre feet of actual inflow into the Klamath Lake. So you're actually creating a system that's going to never going to be met. And 30,000 acre feet is only a start, because they're going to volunteer that in paper water rights. But the actual wording says you have to have an actual increase of inflow into Klamath Lake to meet that 30,000 acre feet. And as you retire more land, your irrigation system is going to be less efficient. So you're going to have to try to pump more water, which you can't legally do in the state of Oregon because of water rights laws. So you have a catch-22 here. As you retire land, the inflow into Klamath Lake is actually going to, our numbers say it's actually going to decrease instead of increase. As agriculture has increased in the upper basin, the actual inflows into Klamath Lake have increased. That sounds kind of ridiculous, but it's actually documented in the 75 years of gauge stations on the rivers if they're going before they go into Klamath Lake. It's actually documented as agriculture increases, irrigated agriculture increases in the upper basin, the inflow into Klamath Lake has increased. So the reverse is absolutely as true as well. If you start retiring irrigated land in the upper basin, the inflow into Klamath Lake is going to drop, not go up.
Thank you. Any other questions?
One other question for Dr.
Still have a lot of witnesses.
Dr. Tucker, and that is you made the comment that the Talladega Irrigation District would not be negatively affected. One of the cornerstones of the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement is to take the difference between the project historical use and the project paper claim, transfer that into the river as environmental water, which would be patent with the same priority date, which would be a patent abrogation of Oregon water law. It's an illegal enlargement of a water right. Having said that, if that came to pass as the agreement is currently written, then the water right, in-stream water right for the Klamath River that would be transferred into the river would be have a priority date considerably better than the Talladega Irrigation District's diversions from Hyatt Lake and Howard Prairie, and I can't see how they couldn't have a call on that water. It's just simply prior appropriations doctrine 101.
Well, I'll be more than happy to clarify that issue and discuss with interested parties way that we can include language in the final draft of KBRA that addresses that concern.
You wanted to comment and to hold the Talladega Irrigation District harmless would then put them out. It would be like, you know, with water law, you have to make a claim on the top drawer and the second drawer and then the third drawer and the fourth drawer, so sort. The Talladega Irrigation District is in the middle. You can't do that and make them whole without making everybody else whole up the line. So I think there's some problems there, Dr. Tucker. Then I think that your comment needs some explanation, and we'll talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'll ask you if you can follow up with Senator Whitsitt afterwards.
Madam Chair, I have to apologize. I did submit the petitions. I think Senator Boquist asked about the 1,850 petitions. I did submit a copy of those to the committee as well today.
Okay, great. We have it. Yes, we have it right here for the record.
Thank you.
Just so you know.
Well, that's only a little tiny bit of it.
Okay, well, just make sure you get it to Beth.
No, I mean, it's up there. It's a pile about that tall.
Okay. You have it.
Okay,
we'll make sure that it gets it.
It's with the keeper of the record.
Right, it's with the keeper of the record.
More importantly,
so this is part of it.
Yes, yes.
It's with the correct person. Thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you,
gentlemen, again for coming here today. Anybody else from 100 miles or more? Okay. Then we're going down to 75 and then to 25 next. I will call up then on the order of how folks signed up. Stephen Cafori, Norm Ritchie, and Michael Early.
No.
Well, if one of you can speak. Okay.
Why don't we keep him close by if we have questions instead of coming? Because if he's not presenting, Steve, what we're trying to do is get people up because the chair has a time.
Right. Okay.
That's fine, man.
Stephen, why don't you go ahead first since you signed up first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here representing the Trust for Public Land. The KBRA is a very complex plan, as you've heard today, that has a lot of ramifications besides what's in this bill. The Trust for Public Land is working with the Klamath Tribe as part of this agreement. The agreement comes to fruition where we will be brokering 90,000 acres of forest land that's come from private hands into the hands of the Klamath Tribe, which is going to help them in their process of reestablishing themselves. And as you know, they were terminated for quite a number of years, and they've just recently become 1986 had the full restoration of their tribe. They had at that time, when the full restoration, only 700 acres. Despite that, they have developed themselves culturally and economically, and this 90,000 acres of forest land would help them very much in that. And this needs to pass in order for that plan, all these things, to come together. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie.
Thank you, Chair Dienfelder and committee. My name is Norman Ritchie. I live in the southeast part of Portland, out towards Gresham, and I'm representing the Association of Northwest Steelheaders here today. The Northwest Steelheaders has about 1,800 members in about 16 chapters around the state, including several along the coast. We are the Oregon affiliate of the National Wildlife Federation and championed a resolution to remove the dams and resolve water use issues. And that resolution was approved by National Wildlife Federation in 2006. So we support the Senate Bill 76-2. One of the statements that was made regarding the marmot issue was that it's entirely different. But at this point in time, in the chain of events, it's exactly the same as marmot. I had the honor of being a signer to that agreement, and I remember right up until the point that the dam was removed, people were claiming that the sediment was going to kill the fish, that it was poisonous, and that it was going to cost tremendous amounts of money, and none of that happened. I'm really glad to hear that the same group that studied that one studied this one, because I'm sure they know what they're talking about. But one of the issues, too, that's been not mentioned here is the fact that our members and others who have volunteered thousands of man-hours and at their own expense to provide salmon and steelhead fishing have generated fish for the ocean fisheries that we have not been able to prosecute because of the restrictions put to save the salmon from the California waters. So this sort of thing will not only help with the fish in those areas, but the hatchery production, proper use throughout the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Mr. Early?
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder and committee members. My name is Michael Early. I'm the Executive Director of the Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. I represent large users of electricity, including industries that are served by PacifiCorp in Oregon. You all have copies of my written testimony in view of the hour. I'd like to limit my comments to two subjects. One is, what is the cost of this bill on Oregon ratepayers, and is that cost capped? Secondly, what is the role of the commission under this bill, and what should their role be? First, we've been talking a lot about things happening in 2020 and fairly far off, but you know, the immediate effect of this bill is we are going to see a rate increase this summer. And it's going to be made up of several components. There's the 2% removal cost piece. There's the additional items, which are in Section 3.2, the five listed additional costs, which will be included in rates in addition to the surcharge. And finally, the bill goes an extraordinary way. It takes away from the commission the rate design of the surcharge. It specifies that it's going to be $1 per kilowatt hour charge, an energy charge. What that means for industrial customers, this isn't going to be a 2% rate increase. It's going to be higher. And because we don't know what are the cost components included in Section 3.2, I can't tell you today, and I don't think PacifiCorp can tell you today, what is the rate increase we're going to see it later this summer. But it's not going to be 2%. It's going to be more. And it's going to occur at a time when many of these industries are struggling. And part of my job is to enable them to continue to employ their people at current employment levels. So I'm concerned about that. Secondly, I want to talk about the costs of this bill. There's been a lot of talk that the costs are capped at $200 million. Well, first, there's a difference between $200 million you spend on dam removal and $200 million you spend on relicensing. If you spend it on relicensing, at the end of the day, you've got a resource. You've got something producing energy. If you spend it on dam removal, at the end, you don't have to resource. You have to go out and spend additional money on high-cost new resources to replace that resource. So that has to be factored into the overall cost of this bill. And the 2% is just the removal cost. It doesn't touch upon the cost that we don't know today to replace that resource. The question was asked to Chairman Beyer, is this a good deal for ratepayers? And he wasn't just dodging the question. He gave the right answer. We don't know today because we don't have the analysis in front of us. And more importantly, you don't know today. And that's why it's important that we preserve the authorities of the commission to make sure when that analysis is done that it is a good deal for Oregon ratepayers. I'd like to focus on one thing in particular, and that is...
Minutes, yeah. Madam Chair.
If you could wrap up, please.
You had conflicting testimony about what was Oregon's fair share. You heard PacifiCorp say it was 90% of the $200 million. Well, that's just not true. Those costs today, absent this law, are allocated based upon this allocated share, which is mentioned in the bill, but not applied to the surcharge. The fact of the matter is that the benefits of that dam, only about 50% of those come to Oregon. The rest go to California, to Washington, to Idaho, to other states. So you're proposing 10 years where those dams continue to operate. The benefits flow to a variety of states, but only 50% of those benefits come to Oregon. And I don't know how to go back to my members and say, you're paying 90% of the dam removal costs and getting 50% of the benefits, and someone in Washington State is getting their share of the benefits, but they're not contributing a dime over the 10 years to that removal cost. And it's not just me, it's not just big users, it's everybody.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for the witnesses here? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Next up, Glenn Spain, Lisa Brown, and Jim Walsh. Welcome. Why don't you go ahead, Glenn?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and guests. My name is Glenn Spain. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, PCFFA. We are the West Coast's largest organization of commercial fishing families. We have members in virtually every port in the western U.S., and many of them are salmon fishermen. Many of them have been closed down for quite some time because of impacts in the Klamath. It is absolutely untrue that there is no direct relationship. When Klamath runs go down, as in 2006, we have a declaration of emergency and we close ports over 700 miles all the way up to the Columbia River and all the way well down into and below San Francisco. That's a huge problem, and it is directly related to poor water quality conditions in the Klamath, which in turn are directly related to the dams. But I don't want to talk about, it's late. I want to cut to the chase here. There's a lot of testimony about the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. All that is irrelevant. This is not the forum for making a decision on the KBRA, as it's called, nor is this the forum for making a decision on whether the dams will or will not come down. That is a decision that PacifiCorp will make as a matter of their private property, and on the basis of what they believe is best for their customers. That's also a decision that will be ultimately made by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So all that is before you right now is whether or not to pass a cap that essentially prevents undue costs or overcharges costs beyond $200 million from being essentially rate recoverable for your for the customers of PacifiCorp. Now, keep in mind that the horse has long since left the barn. We've been in FERC process for years now, and FERC has essentially come to the end of what it can do. It has looked at all the environmental issues. It's looked at all the costs. And at this point, one of two things will happen soon. Either the dams will be relicensed at enormous cost. All the fish passage, all the multiple, I think there are 160 different mitigation measures that would be required by the federal agencies for relicensing. That is going to cost quite a bit more than $200 million in all likelihood. And it will not solve the problems. It will not solve the Clean Water Act problems. It will not solve ESA problems. It will not bring salmon in the upper basin in all likelihood because and it won't solve the tribal treaty obligations. So there will be enormous potential liability even if it is relicensed. Or, As FERC always likes to encourage, there will be a settlement of some sort that will result in decommissioning of the dams. All that is being asked of you in SB 76 is, will you cap the liability of the customers or not? If any of these things happen and there is no cap, all of the customers of PacifiCorp are potentially liable for rates for recovery through the PUC for all prudent costs, and that could be a great deal more than $200 million.
Thank you, Mr. Steen. Ms. Brown.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Atkinson, who's not here anymore, and committee members. For the record, Lisa Brown with Water Watch of Oregon. I want to thank you for your interest in the Klamath Basin and for holding this hearing. And Water Watch has been involved in the basin for many years, and we've got members across the state who care deeply about it. And we are a strong supporter of efforts to remove the dams. We've been very involved in that work. And to that end, we are supportive of the core concept of Senate Bill 76. We do have a few remaining concerns after the Dash 2 amendments, which did make the bill much, much better. First, well, what's now Section 4, Sub 10 in the Dash 2 amendments is significantly improved. Water Watch would like to see that section, instead of saying if money collected for dam removal isn't used for dam removal because a dam won't be removed, that money can be applied to prudently incurred relicensing costs. We think it would be much cleaner and simpler to just say if a dam isn't removed, part of the money collected to remove that dam is simply refunded to customers. And we think that would just be cleaner and ensure that money that's collected is used for the purpose it was collected for. And second, our second concern, which is sort of more overarching, is that Water Watch, we fundamentally disagree with the continued linkage between dam removal and the draft KBRA. Senate Bill 76 does continue this linkage because it triggers collection of the surcharge for dam removal based on the final agreement, which is expected to repeat the AIP's declaration that it's indivisible with the KBRA. The reason we don't think they should be linked is that the draft KBRA, number one, it faces an uncertain future, and number two, it, from our perspective, has a number of problematic provisions. You've heard a lot about the good and the bad here today. I mean, from our perspective, problematic provisions include a $985 million budget, a defective water deal that promises water to the Klamath Irrigation Project but not to rivers and fish, multiple special contracts, groundwater pumping standards that run afoul of Oregon water law, and an attempt to lock in large-scale commercial agriculture on the Tule Lake and Lower Klamath National Wildlife Refuges. And I should touch on, because a number of other people touched on process, I would, related to these provisions, echo the concerns expressed about the process. I think the committee should know that Oregon Wild and Water Watch of Oregon, the two state-based Oregon conservation groups, were ejected from the talks for disagreeing with the refuge farming and river flow protection provisions. So this brings me back to my central point here, which is if dam removal is found prudent by the PUC and it's the best choice for ratepayers, we believe it should not be then linked to the draft KBRA, which is problematic and faces an uncertain future. Let's do dam removal if it's prudent and not tether it that way. And
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have your written testimony, so it's right there. Mr. Welsh.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, Jim Welsh, representing Oregon Cattlemen Association. And I provided you, of course, with some testimony here. Our resolution that we have had for some time is definitely against dam removal, especially dams that are constructed for energy and for definitely green and clean energy reasons, irrigation, flood control. As you can see, our our policy there. We raise some questions in here that need to be answered and are not answered in Senate Bill 76. I don't know if they are in the dash amendments because I have not seen all of those. But we are concerned about the cost to the ratepayer and ultimately cost to possibly the people of the state of Oregon. If there was a default at some point in time, we have been experiencing defaults with institutions that we have not expected. So down the line, the state of Oregon could be on the hook. We know that. But certainly the ratepayers are, you know, the concern for them is the costs that need to be spilled out here all the way through. And for remediation of environmental issues, and for any kind of a cost, even the cost to Pacific Corps for, you know, legal costs, all of this it needs to be spilled out. Ratepayers could be on hook if you do not cap that. But we are mostly concerned about dam removal and those issues, why the dams originally were constructed, those are still viable. And so we do not approve of this bill as it stands. And a lot of our members are down in that area, and I think their concerns need to be addressed. And I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Welsh. And just to clarify, I want to make sure the comments that you submitted, is that on the original bill or the dash twos?
Original.
Okay, so if you have some additional comments on, or changes on the dash two, if you can submit it to the committee staff.
Yeah, any of the dash amendments, Chair, that we will respond to.
Okay. Right. And Madam Chair.
The record is open until 3 o'clock on Thursday.
For Madam Chair, I'm not sure I actually said it, but we are in support of the dash two amendments.
Okay.
I want to set it on the record, and we will submit some written testimony as well.
Great, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you all for coming today and again for your patience. We have three more witnesses that have signed up: Nelson Matthew, Gail Hildreth, and Ronnie Daniels. I don't know if I'm reading that correctly. Okay, come on up, please. Hi, Gail. Why don't you go ahead?
My name is Gail Hildreth Whitsitt. Thank you, members of the committee and Chair Dingfelter. I would like to address Senator Metzger's question that he went over about three times here. A facet of SB 76 is that no one is responsible in the event dam removal results in cost overruns. The agreement in principle, page 9, states, quote, "The final agreement shall resolve how to provide for further funding of costs in excess of the state cost cap if during the process of facilities removal it becomes reasonably apparent that actual facilities removal costs are likely to exceed $450 million or, in fact, do exceed that amount. The United States, California, Oregon, Pacific Corps, and Pacific Corps' customers do not accept liability for any cost in excess of $450 million for facilities removal absent specific subsequent agreement. It seems imprudent to apply $200 million towards a project when there is not currently a plan in place for funding the project in its entirety. It is foreseeable that in the future there will be cost overruns and the state will be required to authorize additional funding or be left with a partially removed dam or set of dams. Undoubtedly, the state will feel compelled to provide additional funding under these circumstances, or perhaps legislation will be required to put the additional charges on the shoulders of the ratepayers. The state should wait until there is a plan in place for funding the entire cost of dam removal before investing money in this project. Otherwise, the initial contribution puts the state in a position where it will be required to either force taxpayers or ratepayers to cover a portion or all of the unforeseen costs associated with the dam removal. I would like to further address the single largest landowner in the Klamath Water Users Association sent Senator Atkinson in our office an email stating his opposition to SB 76. William D. Kennedy is also on the board of directors for the Klamath Water Users Association, and he stated unequivocally that the KWUA members are not all in complete agreement with the testimony presented today in favor of SB 78. And one last thing I'd like to mention, that on page 6 of the agreement in principle, it states that the United States shall designate a non-federal DRE, dam removal entity, to remove the facilities. So I just want everybody to understand that the United States government will not be the dam removal entity. It will be a private group, and we need to understand who's liable for the excess if we run into cost overruns on that. It won't be the federal government.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
My name is Ronnie Daniels. I'm out of Senator Boquist District, and I want to address, as a little Joe blue collar that just took a day off work to address this issue, I hear this members talk about we need to address green power, okay? And I hear that they want to address salmon. First thing, we've been spending billions of dollars on the salmon the last 20 years. Okay, let's go to the facts. We even shut down hatcheries due to economic times in the Gruen-Gosk administrations, okay? Nobody in the legislature addressed the salmon issue about the 100-mile, the 10-mile, 1-mile nets that done by international fisheries. That may be the biggest problem besides the warming of the waters. But getting back to the dams, I believe that they should stay there, should be modified, and should be set up for the salmon accordingly. Number one, our renewable resources is not set into the grid yet for this region. Number two, if they do take the dams out, what is the unknown cost of going back to carbon neutral, like natural gas, or carbon-based, like coal that might be out of the state that we're buying power from? They say, well, 60 to 150 megawatts ain't much. But yet, me, Joe taxpayer, or me, Joe ratepayer, who watched his utility rates go double in the last few years due to the economic uncertainties, is paying the cost no matter what. This legislative body needs to figure out, and I'm just sitting back on the sidelines, as they say, sitting on the bar watching all the bartenders, you know. And the fact is, what I see is that we got an economic destruction coming upon us. Number one, we're in an economic situation. They say we're going to cap for the rec pairs $1.50. Okay? Let's go to the facts. When they shut the power off in 2020, when they have to hook that power into the grid, that 60 to 150 megawatts that they got power in, if it's going to be carbon neutral based, it's going to cost me about $7 on top of that $1.50 per month. Let's go right to the chase, or more, if the inflation don't kill us. Second fact is, you're looking at the water issue. The farmers, if you don't realize, they supply at least 25 to 35% of the alfalfa and various other grass hays that is exported out of this country or serve the Willamette Valley. As a friend of mine who has roping cattle, and we raise longhorns for also for meat, the price of alfalfa is $265 a ton. You take those farms out of that equation, my cost to that farmer might be paying an extra $15 to $25 a ton more out of the minimum. The third of the issue is I believe that the questions I've been hearing about the sediment and various other things, that ain't even been given to the general public. I'm Joe taxpayer. Speak to me. Don't speak to these Dowden Thompson and the money changers. But give us something. Come straight out. Not no legalese. Put it in plain English. That's all I got.
Thank you, Mr. Daniels. Any questions?
Here.
Okay. Anybody else would like to testify? Okay, can you come up, please? State your name for the record. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve West. I am a registered lobbyist, but I do not have a client involved in this issue. What I do have is over 30 years of my life in this issue. And I didn't come here to testify today. I've sat through the whole hearing. I'm compelled to testify. That 30 years of my life was first spent 9 years living in Humboldt County, California, which is the mouth of the Klamath River, where it empties into the ocean. For 23 years of my life, I lived in Klamath County. 8 years of that, I spent as a county commissioner. I was chairman of the Board of Commissioners in 2001 during the water crisis. I have dear friends on both sides of this issue. The other perspective I bring to this is I spent 12 years working for Pacific Power, 11 years of that in the Klamath Basin. And I just like to give you a few things to think about. Again, I didn't bring any prepared remarks. These are not the Bonneville dams. This is not the Columbia River system. These are six small generation facilities that the nameplate rating on those turbines is about 160 megawatts. They produce far less than that. My guess is, I don't know for sure because I've only been a Mid-Valley resident for about 3 years, is that the trash burner in Brooks produces more megawatt hours than the dams on the Klamath River. In reality, the ratepayers of Pacific Power have been subsidizing the Klamath Basin for 50 years. And the reason I say that is that in the Bureau of Reclamation rate from 1956 to 2006, the people under that file tariff paid about a half a cent a megawatt hour. So in reality, the customers were already subsidizing the Klamath Basin. I don't know anywhere else in the Northwest where there is such an opportunity for a win-win by removing dams. There are two dams that are desperately needed to stay in that are required to operate the Klamath Irrigation Project, which I do support, and that's the Link River Dam and Keno Dam. The Link River Dam already has state-of-the-art fish passage. I believe the Bureau of Reclamation spent about $17 million putting in state-of-the-art fish passage. So fish passage does need to be improved on Keno Dam. The other dams do not contribute to the Klamath Irrigation Project. They can be removed. Anadromous fish runs can be restored to the very upper reaches of the Klamath Basin where they were historically. I'm not a biologist. I'm married to a pretty good one. And it's my understanding is that the anadromous fish runs were spring runs when the water was high. So when you hear about the low water levels in the fall, the salmon were not migrating during that period. They were migrating in the spring runs, is my understanding. So I guess my point is, I think you need to ask some hard questions that I haven't heard asked. And I wish you the very best in your deliberation. But I really do think that this is a tremendous opportunity to solve a problem that's been around for a long time. When those dams were installed, they were installed with the very best science available at the time and based on social values of the time. The people made good decisions, but those social values have changed. And now we have a unique opportunity to fix things while maintaining a viable agricultural community and restoring an adverse fish run. So I hope we make those steps. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, Senator, what's it?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Thanks for being here, Steve.
Sure.
You mentioned that the Pacific Corps ratepayers had subsidized the Klamath Basin for all this time. Are you unfamiliar with the BOR contract that swapped? And the BOR contract and the irrigators contract is swapped the run of the river to Pacific Corps for the low power rates, and that was a contractual obligation for 100 years.
Sure, so
I have a problem with the characterization of a subsidy. It was a business. It was a business contract between the irrigators and Pacific Corps. When after 100 years, Pacific Corps chose not to renew the contract, and that was the genesis of the rate swap, or the Senate Bill 21, the rate shock bill that we passed to help raise that cost up to tariff, full tariff by steps. So,
would you like to respond?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Whitsitt. It was a 50-year contract from 1956 to 2006 because I can remember working for Pacific Corps, and we all hoped to be out of the Klamath Basin before 2006 because no one wanted to face the end of that contract. That is my terminology, subsidized. In reality, what Pacific Corps owns on the Klamath River are some rather large chunks of concrete and reinforcing rod. Without the water, that's all they are. So the fuel that fueled those projects were the water, and I think the people own the water. I can remember standing with customers trying to explain having a customer on the California side of the border with power line on the Oregon side of the border, and the tap went to the Oregon, to the California customer, and the tap that went across the street to their neighbor on the Oregon side, and trying to explain the difference in rates to those two customers from the same power line. So that's my word, subsidized. I believe that within the overall rate structure that Pacific Power had for all those years, that discrepancy in the rates, the extremely low rate that the irrigators were paying, was being made up for throughout the system.
Thank you. With that,
one last comment, and then I'm going to close the public hearing. Actually, Steve, the 1956 contract was a renewal of the first contract, so that there was actually a better part of 100 years, and we can respectfully disagree on the subsidy.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
with
fine.
That,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 76. We'll close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Thank you all for your patience. Thank you, committee members, for your staying late. We'll see you next Thursday.